rejuvenated and ready for a presentation from our final two advisory panels. And to kick off the present, we will follow basically the same format as this morning with about a half an hour presentation from the team, and then followed by as much as an hour of Q&A. So hopefully that'll work well. These are two very meaty topics we're heading into here. So so rest assured, I expect some robust discussion will ensue. But to kick us off, I would like to turn the presentation over to Ruth Ann Visnauskas, Commissioner of Homes and Community Renewal, to discuss the Housing and Energy Efficiency Advisory Panel along with her colleagues. So Ruth Ann.
Thank you, Doreen, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to be joining so many of my colleagues and members of the Climate Action Council and fellow New Yorkers to talk about our efforts in the building sector to achieve the CLCPA goals. I know that many eyes are on us as we move forward with this initiative and we put nation-leading best practices and processes into place. And in common with the other panels, you know, what we're talking about here is really making fundamental changes to the state's building sector, our residential, our commercial, our institutional buildings. And while these changes will feel huge and gravitational, they really are required to change the way that we all make choices, the way that we do business, and the way that we can deliver on a promise to reduce our emissions. Next slide. As with my fellow panelists, I want to thank all my colleagues on the Energy Efficiency and Housing panel. We really had an incredible group of professionals that have worked tirelessly and been so thoughtful and steadfast and devoted and spent countless hours developing and refining the recommendations that we're going to talk through here today. Their names are outlined here on this slide, and I just want to personally thank them on behalf of myself and also the whole team for their hard work and their commitment. I think we've really come to a great place. And I also want to especially thank Janet Joseph, NYSERDA's Senior Vice President, who has been an incredible partner on this in this process and is also going to join me today in making this presentation. We'll try to spice it up a little bit by handing things off as everybody digests a little bit of their lunch. So next slide. First, let's talk about greenhouse gas emissions that are attributable to the building sector and introduce some basic terms. So we look at emission sources by sector. As you can see in the graph on the left, statewide buildings account for a major portion of our annual greenhouse gas emissions, about 30%. Our panel is primarily concerned with what's termed direct emissions from buildings measured in metric tons. So these emissions come directly from the source, in this case, burning fossil fuels in the buildings themselves. You can see that residential is slightly higher than commercial, gas is a larger source than other fuels. And you can see, looking all the way to the right, that space heating and water heating, whether residential or commercial, really use the lion's share of fossil fuels. There's also indirect emissions. These would be the emissions that are produced in the production and the usage of electricity. And these emissions are dealt with by our colleagues on the power grid panel coming up next. Although many of the recommendations advanced by our panel also serve to conserve electricity. So in short, we're lowering or eliminating the reliance on these fuels in both existing and new buildings. And we see that as the only way for the housing and building sector to reduce direct emissions and make a substantial contribution to getting us to our 2030 and our 2050 goals. Next slide. So the strategy for the building sector focuses on building electrification, energy efficiency, and maximizing grid connectivity and solar. So in order to achieve this transformation, we need to require electrification of systems that currently use fossil fuels. And we need to do that in both new buildings as well as existing buildings, both the equipment, but also the building envelope, which includes the walls, the windows, the roof. They all need to be energy efficient. In the near future, as you can see in this sort of diagram on the right-hand side of the slide, whether it's a commercial or residential building, small or large, really little to no fossil fuel combustion will be part of the building's heating, cooling, hot water, cooking, and laundry. Next slide. So we want to talk at the scale of the issue and the scale of the solution. So if you look at the graph, you can see that as of 2018, we estimate that the sector accounts for about 115 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent. Fuel combustion in residential and commercial buildings drove a majority of the emissions. You can see in the imported fossil fuels that emissions associated with extracting, processing, and transporting these fuels. And then finally, HFCs, used mainly for refrigerants, accounted for almost all the increase in emissions since 1990 when they weren't in use. And these emissions are going to need to be reduced dramatically, even as the use of air conditioning and heat pumps expands. So we believe that what we will go through with you today is really a solid set of recommendations that will get us to nearly a 30% reduction from the 1990 levels by 2030 and put us on track to reduce emissions from New York's buildings by about 85% by 2050. And these reduction estimates will also form part of the broader integration analysis that was talked about this morning, where the council will begin to look at some different scenarios and trade-offs to achieve the economy-wide goals. Next slide. So the scale of the problem also requires a large solution. So the scale of the effort is quite daunting. There's about 6.2 million buildings in New York State. The majority of these are single family homes, and about 70% of the buildings were constructed before the energy code. So they weren't really designed to be energy efficient, and these buildings are really gonna need both investment and upgrading. But our opportunity here is to upgrade the quality of our existing housing and also to see new residential and commercial buildings constructed to new standards. It's gonna require new resources, it's gonna require legislation, and we need to do this work through the lens of equity. We want to make sure that we focus on aiding the transition for all communities in our state, particularly those that are traditionally underserved. So as you can see on the right-hand side of the slide, we have some numbers. By 2030, more than 200,000 homes every year will need to upgrade to all electric and energy efficient systems. We need to be sure that the grid is ready for that. And the 370,000 office, retail, restaurant, school, and warehouse buildings across the state are going to need to cut their energy usage in half and stop using fossil fuels for heating and hot water. And we'll get there with sort of three key strategies. One, bringing private capital investment into the market to construct and upgrade and operate highly efficient buildings that can be powered by zero emissions electricity. Two, investing public resources to support market initiatives and incentives to get to early adoption of these technologies. And three, investing public resources to fund building efficiency and electrification in low and moderate income communities, affordable and public housing, and disadvantaged communities. And I'll use those three terms as both Janet and I talk through this presentation to sort of encompass, what are sort of the targeted areas that we believe really will need direct assistance. And we need to do this while we support energy affordability, healthy housing, economic opportunities, and a repair of structural inequalities. No doubt a very complex task. And all of this is going to require regulatory signals. Next slide. And I want to talk for a minute about jobs and job growth. The panel agreed that really all of these efforts have to be tied to bringing new technology to scale and making a commitment to job growth and expansion of opportunity. There's more than 127,000 workers that hold good jobs in the energy efficiency sector. They're designing and installing high efficiency technologies like heat pumps, efficient air conditioning, Energy Star appliances, LED lighting, insulation, and advanced building materials. And energy efficiency jobs are found in every county and make up over three quarters of all clean energy jobs in New York. A return to pre-COVID growth trends would add another 70,000 good-paying and specialized jobs in the energy efficiency sector over the next decade, and we expect even more growth is needed to deliver on the state's decarbonization goals. Next slide. So a little bit on our approach and the approach of our panel. So to be truly successful, all communities have to realize and see the benefits, especially those that have been historically disadvantaged. So you hear from us that equity is a central tenet of the recommendations of our panel. We have to address new construction and retrofits for single family housing, multifamily housing, and commercial and institutional buildings. And we identified a series of sort of principles to guide us through that include equity and affordability, right? So making sure that there aren't negative impacts on low and moderate income households and disadvantaged communities. Practicality, we have to have practical implementation strategies for this work. Minimizing costs, making sure this work can be less expensive and competitive. Expanding solutions, so making sure we're talking about technology and innovation. Benefits, making sure that we're talking about health and other benefits that come along with these types of investments. And finally, sustainable and resilient outcomes. And this is, as you heard sort of Sarah talk about in the land use panel, identifying and avoiding outcomes that lead to less sustainable development patterns and development in climate at-risk areas. So you'll hear a lot of that echoed as we talk through our recommendations. New York State is a leader on this, but we certainly need significant partnership with all levels of government, including local and federal, to bring all these recommendations to fruition. Next slide. So finally, I want to highlight some of the outreach and engagement that we've done. So from the start, as with the other panels, we have met with experts and stakeholders from the public and the private and the nonprofit sector. We started our public meetings back in April, and at every step of the way, we solicited feedback from both industry professionals and also everyday New Yorkers. For example, in our February public engagement session, we had 270 attendees from outside of government, and we got more than 110 unique comments and in response to follow-up emails. We've also met with advocates and residential property owner associations. We've listened to and read and considered with care every comment that we received. So for the next segment, I'm gonna hand it over to Janet, and she is gonna talk us through the mitigation strategies. Janet?
Okay, well, good afternoon. Thank you, Commissioner. Can you move to the next slide, please? So we have four major mitigation recommendations, and we have outlined key components to put each of these into action. Our panel considered each recommendation's potential to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We considered practicality of implementation. We looked at economics and opportunities for cost reduction, and importantly, the potential impacts on disadvantaged communities. The four mitigation strategies are shown here, and they include phasing out fossil fuel use in buildings over time, which is fundamental to decarbonizing buildings, requiring benchmarking to provide critical information for consumers, shifting reliance on fossil fuel gas to a clean energy system. And this is a major cross-cutting issue, not unique to buildings, but absolutely central to our work. And lastly, reducing use of another major greenhouse gas, hydrofluorocarbon refrigerants. Next slide, please. So our first strategy is the most transformative. It uses codes and regulatory standards to send a clear market signal, ending reliance on fossil fuel in buildings, phasing in over time. To do this, the state needs to enact legislation and adopt building codes, equipment standards, and regulations to improve energy efficiency, reduce emissions, and enhance building resilience. And we heard a good bit about the role of building codes this morning from the local government group and from council members. I want to make it clear that what the panel is proposing here is a statewide mandatory code that raises the bar. Now, this will no doubt take a committed public to support these legislative, regulatory, and programmatic changes. And while these changes may not be easy, it was the consensus of the panel that without these clear regulatory signals, in addition to market-enabling supports, we will not achieve our critical greenhouse gas goals. Now, from a cost perspective, this regulatory strategy will drive the scale and the certainty that's needed to transform the market, to facilitate investment, and to reduce cost. And from a benefits perspective, the electrification, efficiency, and resiliency measures in buildings that will be driven by these policies will improve quality of life and health and will result in cleaner air as on-site combustion is phased out. Next slide, please. So now moving on to some of the critical elements, and let's start first with new construction. So we need to ensure that new residential and commercial buildings are built to a highly efficient zero emission standard and incorporate resilience across New York State. There are three major elements required to do this. First, we need a highly efficient state energy code. We need to stop wasting energy in buildings. Second, we need to incorporate low carbon resiliency solutions. And we have outlined a few of these resiliency solutions on this slide here. And lastly, we need to move to an all-electric code for new construction. The panel is recommending that by 2025 for single-family homes and by 2030 for multifamily and commercial buildings, the state code should prohibit gas and oil equipment for space conditioning and hot water in all new construction. Now, the technologies to do this for new construction are commercially viable today and economic in many circumstances. Now, I will note to the question raised this morning, we do need to make some legislative changes to start this shift. There are limits to what Department of State can do today under the current code structures. And there is also an active bill in the legislature today to advance on some of these elements. So this is a high level view of what we need to do for new construction. But the scope of our policies needs to go beyond new buildings and address the millions of buildings that we have across New York State, the majority of which will still be around by 2050. Next slide, please. So this slide outlines codes and standards that will drive substantial emission reduction in existing buildings. And remember, as the commissioner said, we have 6 million buildings across New York State. The strategy here is focused on the sale and the installation of efficient and zero emission equipment when replaced at the end of useful life. Now, this feature, targeting replacement of equipment at the end of its useful life, is being advanced to contain costs. The panel was very mindful of the need to target policies at the natural investment points in the life cycle of a building or a piece of equipment to contain costs. Now, in the very near term, we need to adopt energy efficiency standards for appliances that are not otherwise regulated by the federal government. So this means that when a consumer goes to purchase one of these devices, they will only be able to buy an energy efficient one. And the net benefits of this type of appliance standard is in the tens of billions of dollars for consumers in New York State. And by 2030, an energy efficiency performance standard for all existing large commercial properties would ensure managed demands on a clean electric grid. And that is indeed one of the foundational recommendations of the panel. Ultimately, the state will need to enact emission-based standards that prohibit replacing space conditioning and water heating equipment with fossil fuel new equipment. Now, this approach is similar to what was discussed this morning for transportation, where we're talking about 100% zero emission vehicle sale regulation by 2035. In the building space, the panel is recommending 100% zero emission appliance sales regulations by 2035, starting first with single family in 2030. And these regulations, and as these regulations roll out, the state will need to give thoughtful consideration to the diversity of extenuating circumstances across the variety of buildings that we have in New York State. And one point on timing here, we're proposing a number of very specific dates here. Our panel had extensive deliberations around specific milestone dates. And in coming up with these milestone dates, we considered the market readiness, we considered the grid readiness, as well as the greenhouse gas emission impact. So on to the next slide, please. So this next mitigation strategy is really a data play, and it requires measuring building energy use and making that information available via disclosures. We need to start to bring consumers along with this transition, and that's what this strategy is about. Now, the costs and the risks to require benchmarking of this type are quite low, and we know that better information makes us better consumers and can unlock demand for energy efficiency services. And these types of benchmarking requirements are in place in localities across the country, and in fact, in New York City. So we're not talking about a voluntary situation here. We're talking about making this a mandate across the state. Next slide, please. So the panel is recommending that we launch a statewide energy benchmarking and disclosure program as soon as possible, requiring owners of large properties to annually report on their building energy and water consumption. Within a few years after that, starting in 2025 for large buildings and in 2027 for single family buildings, that energy use would need to be disclosed as part of a sale or a lease. And all of this will inform future policies and improvements to energy programs and allow us to reach our climate goals faster. Next slide, please. So this next major mitigation strategy is a big one, and it focuses on the natural gas transition. As the council well knows, New York will need to dramatically reduce the use of fossil fuel gas for power generation in our buildings and in industry. So the overarching recommendation here is that we need to advance a managed, phased, and just transition from reliance on fossil fuel natural gas and the gas distribution system to a clean energy system, including elimination of embedded subsidies for fossil gas. And we need to start this now. This will be hard work, no doubt, requiring careful technical analysis and politically difficult decisions, and likely will need to play out over several years. It could be costly, although with long-term planning and careful phasing, we can potentially mitigate the risks and the costs of stranded assets in the gas system. Now, New York is at the starting gate here, along with a few other states, in opening up a gas planning proceeding under the Public Service Commission, which will drive toward more transparent gas system planning that aligns with our broader energy and climate goals. But we have much to do ahead in this regard. Next slide, please. And while there was debate about the speed at which this transition needs to occur or can occur, there was agreement on the need to commence this careful, inclusive, and phased planning with attention to safety, reliability, and affordability of service, with attention to understanding end user impacts, attention to investigating options for contracting the physical footprint of our gas system, and exploring alternative business and regulatory models for gas utilities in the long term. Now, concurrently, we need to develop a comprehensive equity strategy to incorporate the needs of low and moderate income households and disadvantaged communities in this transition to ensure that they are not left behind. We also need to create an equitable transition plan for the gas industry workforce. And fundamentally, this work needs to minimize new investments in gas delivery infrastructure that are not otherwise needed for safety and reliability. So this means changing utility incentives, planning, investment processes, depreciation schedules, and many other facets of how this industry is developed, regulated, and financed. Next slide, please. Now, there are also steps that New York can take concurrent with planning, and the panel has outlined a few of these. These include discontinuing marketing of natural gas as a clean and environmentally friendly solution, phasing out incentives for fossil fuel gas equipment, ensuring that up-to-date transparent information is available around grid readiness down to the building level so that building owners can plan how and when to go electric. We've had to do something like this for solar, and I think Dennis pointed to it this morning, mapping out hosting capacity. Well, utilities will need to do something a little bit different for building electrification, but it's that same transparency that owners will need to ensure how and when they can make a switch. The panel also recommended eliminating the 100-foot rule to make gas hookups less attractive. Today, the policy requires that the utility cover most or all of the cost of a new gas connection for residential customers, and those gas hookup costs are then socialized across the rate base. And there will need to be some changes considered in the public service law, among other things. Now, these recommendations are admittedly just scratching the surface, given the complexity of this topic. but they do provide a view of some early action steps that we can take in the near term. Next slide, please. So this final mitigation strategy focuses on a different type of greenhouse gas, specifically hydrofluorocarbons or HFCs. These chemicals are potent greenhouse gases and they're used in refrigeration, air conditioning, and heat pumps, as well as in spray foam insulation. You may recall from the commissioner's opening remarks that refrigerants are responsible for a little bit under 20% of the total greenhouse gas emissions from buildings. So we need to transition from the use of HFCs as refrigerants and in building construction products. Now here, we're fortunate in that the federal government, other states, and industry are working to drive toward technologies that use alternative refrigerants that have much lower climate impact. We do think this work could be challenging given the rapid timeframe that we need to operate within. But by aligning New York State policy with other leading states and the federal EPA, we can send a strong signal to the industry while mitigating costs of the transition. Next slide, please. So there are a couple of critical elements to drive this transition from HFCs. We need to update the New York State building codes to allow low global warming potential refrigerants. This is an example of a change we need to make in the code to move us forward. Again, a point that was raised this morning. We have to require reclamation or destruction of refrigerants from appliances at the end of their life. And I believe the waste panel also touched on this. And critically, we will need to make some changes to the existing DEC refrigerant rules to drive toward new low and ultra low global warming potential technologies, again, in a manner that aligns with federal policies. Next slide, please. So to sort of wrap up the benefits and impacts of these four big buckets of mitigation strategies, these strategies would drive significant reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, roughly 30% reduction in emission by 2030 and 85% by 2050. If paired with the enabling initiatives that the commissioner will speak to next, these strategies will deliver broad economic and social benefits. Now, our panel is recommending a comprehensive package in order to advance equitable outcomes. You know, we can improve housing quality and expand economic opportunity for low-income households and disadvantaged communities. To do this, we will need to invest public funding to support building upgrades in disadvantaged communities and for low-income households, and to avoid the risk of disinvestment in certain areas of the state, in certain buildings. Likewise, we need to prioritize training and job placement for priority populations, and we'll get into this more in a few minutes. With respect to public health, the bottom line here is that these initiatives will reduce carbon pollution and will improve outdoor and indoor air quality. Buildings that undertake these upgrades will be safer and more comfortable, which will benefit our productivity and our quality of life. And the potential to create local clean energy jobs is nowhere greater than in the building sector. 75% of clean energy jobs are in the building sector and energy efficiency. So while the costs associated with this transformation of our building infrastructure are not insignificant, the potential for new economic opportunity, including opportunities for those who have been historically disadvantaged, is quite great. So with that overview of our mitigation recommendations, I'm pleased to pass the floor back to Commissioner Visnaskis to speak to the enabling strategies that will be needed to build better living spaces, better working spaces, and stronger communities for all New Yorkers, consistent with our climate and equity goals. So Commissioner, back to you.
Thank you, Janet. If we could advance to the next slide, I hope everybody's caffeine is just starting to kick in. So we're going to go into six enabling strategies around public financial incentives, public and private low-cost financing, workforce, public awareness and consumer education, investments in new technology and innovation, and reducing embodied carbon. So I'm going to talk through each of these strategies. They are comprehensive and they require different levels of commitment and implementation and for cost. Next slide. So the first one is around public financial incentives. So moving forward, we'll have to provide incentives for residential, commercial, and institutional owners to make these changes. We need the incentives to speed the uptake of building efficiency, electrification, and decarbonization. And we have to focus on low-income households and disadvantaged communities so they're not left behind or unfairly burdened. We anticipate that at least $1 billion annually in funding is needed specifically for programs that serve both low and moderate income households, affordable housing and public housing, and disadvantaged communities. Financial incentives to motivate the owners of market rate housing and commercial buildings will also be needed, at least for the coming decade. Next slide. So a little more detail on these public financial incentives. So, we need to modify our frameworks to make sure that our programs that we have now align with state objectives. We need to create direct cash incentives for electrical service upgrades to help offset the costs of getting a building ready for electrification. We need to expand and create new cash incentives for energy efficiency with a priority on low and moderate income households and disadvantaged communities. The panel also wanted to ensure that we support and accelerate efficiency and electrification and resiliency in public housing across the state. As many people know, in addition to NYCHA in New York City, there's over 30,000 units of public housing outside New York City, and public housing often serves the most vulnerable individuals and households in our state. So we need to identify funding sources that can support retrofits and electrification, including support for things like resiliency centers that provide safe temperatures and backup power and community spaces during times of disaster. The panel had a recommendation about creating a retrofit and electrification readiness fund that could supplement these other incentives and cover costs for non-energy building improvements that are often necessary to undertake energy projects in buildings. And lastly, a recommendation around leveraging healthy home services and funding across housing and health and energy for low-income households. Next slide. So in addition to public financial incentives, we have a recommendation around public and private low-cost financing. So the sheer scale of this transformation requires that we unlock private capital so that we can provide low-cost financing to homeowners and building owners and do this at scale. Right now, there's not really a large amount of awareness or regulatory signals for the market to stimulate developing these types of financial structures. And so we want to make sure that we send signals and we have tailored tools so that low-income households and buildings and disadvantaged communities can equally participate and also be protected from any predatory lending that might emerge in the market. Next slide. So a little more detail on this public and private low-cost financing includes first is lender underwriting. So making sure we have a starting point for lenders so they can underwrite to energy performance standards and applicable regulatory requirements. Two, making sure that as requirements for green become more central to affordable housing, that we streamline access to incentives and resources for affordable housing to make it sort of seamless and painless to both build and retrofit energy efficient, all electric or electric ready and resilient developments. Third, as has been mentioned, we have almost 5 million single family homes in the state. And so in terms of retrofitting those homes, we need to make sure that there's more access to low cost financing products for low income homeowners. We also want to expand the use of performance contracting to achieve goals for state and municipal and K-12 school building upgrades. And lastly, partnering with the private sector to create a revolving loan fund for building decarbonization. Next slide. So we've talked a little bit about workforce, and our third initiative focuses on that. The transformation needed to decarbonize New York's buildings is enormous, but so is the job growth and economic development opportunity. So to enable this transformation, we need to equip the state's current and future workforce with the skills so they can design, construct, and operate healthy, comfortable, low-carbon buildings. And we want to make sure that we prioritize that training and job placement for disadvantaged communities and low-income residents so that we can deliver the economic benefits. Next slide. So some more specifics on the workforce. In order to meet the state's climate goals, we will require a significant scaling up in the workforce. And to make it happen, we need to enhance the skills of existing workers. For example, training conventional HVAC contractors in how to install heat pumps. We need to train and prepare new workers for clean energy jobs. And we need to equip adjacent industries, for example, real estate professionals, home health workers, with knowledge and skills to advance low carbon buildings through their work. This will require expanding training infrastructure, new career pathway programs, and partnerships with the industry. And this work would build upon investments that NYSERDA is already making through its $100 million clean energy workforce training initiative. To ensure a just and equitable transition, we must make the training and the job placement in disadvantaged communities and for low-income individuals a priority of ours. This should be done by creating community-to-employment pipelines and accessible career pathway programs. We should promote good wages, benefits, local and targeted training and hiring through models like community benefits agreements. And we can leverage state agency spending and influence and advance commitments around job access and job quality for distressed communities. We also have an opportunity to expand the market share of qualified MWBEs and SDVOBs through increased access to training and business development support. We can require the state-of-the-art building decarbonization curricula in public education from K-12 schools through universities. And finally, we would recommend requiring continuing ed on building decarbonization as part of a licensing for architects, engineers, trades, contractors, building services, and real estate professionals. All of this will help create the clean energy workforce that we need to transform our building stock and to share in its economic benefits. Next slide. So the fourth enabling initiative is really around public awareness and consumer education. We need a broad-based public outreach campaign to catalyze the market and demand for low carbon solutions. It's essential that we create a sense of shared responsibility because we want consumers to start to think about what kind of stove do they want. We want them to seek out heat pumps. We have to spur this type of behavior with repeated and trusted messages, with data, with testimonials, and with local engagement. Next slide. So some more points on what a public awareness and consumer education strategy could look like. It would include supporting and scaling up multilingual public and consumer ed through large-scale coordinated awareness and inspiration and education campaigns. That could be traditional media, it could be digital communication, we could do influencer-style campaigns and so on. We also need to build strategic partnerships that can have broad impact, including partnerships with utilities, with trusted community leaders and organizations, with unions and business councils, and with state and local elected officials. We also have to provide technical assistance and resources for building decision makers and also for building residents. And we want to emphasize that messages, messengers, and media must represent disadvantaged communities in their marketing efforts and prioritize education and technical assistance for those same communities. We also need to make it easier for these communities to access the information, access incentives, and access financing that they will need in order to make action. So this would include something like a one-stop shop website, creating community hubs that can provide education, technical assistance, and program navigator support. And this builds on work that's already underway by NYSERDA and the New York State Utilities for low and moderate income households. We also want to highlight those who do good. So we want to make sure we publicize best practices and leaders. Next slide. Okay, number five, and then I'll have one more after this. Innovation. So as we move forward, so will the technology and economic opportunities. We recommend enabling and supporting research and development, demonstration projects, and more companies and manufacturers operating in New York State so we can bring innovation and scalable solutions to the marketplace. Next slide. So the components we need for this innovation delivery really requires bringing technology into the forefront and adopting and adapting existing techniques to the New York market. We should advocate for federal government R&D funding and partner with national labs. With R&D funding, we would propose targeting more flexible, affordable solutions, including next generation heating and cooling systems, efficient and affordable building envelopes, grid interactive efficient buildings, and resilience solutions. Supporting the transfer of the best technologies that are emerging internationally to New York State is a great approach, and it's also a way to bring new clean energy businesses and new manufacturing to the state. Again, it's important to support the full participation of the underrepresented women and minority entrepreneurs. And to do so, we want to make sure we dedicate access to expert advisory services, to professional development, and also to venture capital for those folks. Next slide. Embodied carbon. So New York also needs to take a leadership role to lower the embodied carbon of products and materials that are used in the building sector. So to do so, the state should establish procurement requirements and design specs for state-funded projects and support education, building reuse, R&D, and also in-state manufacturing of alternative products. Embodied carbon accounts for the carbon footprint of all the materials that we use in building construction. So for example, concrete is a staple of the construction industry. It's also one of the biggest producers of greenhouse gases. And lower carbon concrete is available today. Next slide. So how do we do this? First and foremost, New York State should lead by example in state-funded building projects. We can require environmental product declarations for structural building materials and products used. We can promote the use of available modeling software and design tools for embodied carbon calculations. We can require that state-funded projects follow low carbon specs for carbon-intense building materials and products. And after we gain more experience and data, we should set targets that lower the allowable embodied carbon for our projects. Other things that we can and should do include providing support for in-state manufacturing for products that are lower embodied carbon, like low carbon concrete, or made of carbon sequestering materials like sustainable wood products. And we should always encourage building reuse beginning in our urban centers. Next slide. So each of the strategies and initiatives we just reviewed has benefits and impacts, especially with respect to disadvantaged communities and low and moderate income households. They impact our health and they impact our workforce. This slide highlights what we see as the logical results from these recommendations, from the repair of structural inequalities to improved air quality to increased rates of job growth. The recommendations have robust positive impacts, not only with respect to our greenhouse gas emissions, but to our society as a whole. And just as the CLCPA was intending, the reduction in greenhouse gas has a ripple effect, and our panel has thoughtfully considered each of the impacts. Next slide. So we're going to talk a little bit about cross-cutting panel recommendations. An important part of the work was not to look just at buildings, but across sectors, especially with respect to resources. So if we take it step by step, we realize that change at this scale and making it happen to advance equity will require new resources. This is a cross-sectoral undertaking and requires coordination of private capital and public resources. As mentioned before, our panel identified some recommendations to raise capital and for public incentives. But that said, we recognize the need for resources is greater than even the scope of this panel. So for that reason, we recommended that the CAC conduct an economy-wide analysis to operate in parallel with the integration analysis so we can identify resources and funding mechanisms to holistically address the ultimate scoping plan. We also believe that the CAC should create an advisory body to engage private sector sources of capital and financial institutions that can support the larger economy-wide analysis. Next slide. So in addition to the cross-sectoral analysis, the panel also identified cross-cutting recommendations that span our proposed strategies. First, climate change is a global problem, and we recommend that the CAC advocate for federal resources and policy support. The panel also recommends using ongoing PSC attention to rate design and retail rate price signals. We support the Adaption and Resilience Group and recommend changes to our state codes to enhance building and grid resilience. And finally, the panel identified that regulations and substantial subsidies will be needed to increase efficiency measures at scale. So that means at a minimum, funding for low and moderate income efficiency efforts will be needed and will be increased along with requiring energy disclosures. Next slide. There were some additional panel perspectives that came up. Each of the ones below were put forward by some panel members, but were not incorporated into the final set of recommendations. Nevertheless, they're all worthy of consideration and include advocating for a more robust federal agenda, expanding the weatherization assistance program. We've listed here just a handful of ideas coming from our panel that we wanted to highlight. And next slide. So this is a lot to absorb. I want to thank everyone for their time and their attention. Our full deck, including slides that we didn't run through in detail, will be available after the meeting. And I want to make sure that even though we didn't walk through every word on every slide, we really tried to cover all the important aspects of some of the work that our panel did. There is a lot of systemic change and a lot of resources that need to come into play to support an equitable transformation here. And I hope we've done a good job at covering the breadth of those. It's really been my honor to chair the Energy Efficiency and Housing Panel alongside Janet Joseph and have the opportunity to work with the panel members. I hope people feel confident that we've put together a really solid recommendations and would be happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Janet. Very complex topic, and I know we ran over on time, and as a result, I'm going to ask the members to just try to keep your questions focused on the questions at hand, just to try to expedite the process. I have been keeping track of those whose hands have been raised. Just checking, Rose Harvey, your hand has been up since before the lunch break. Did you have a question, Rose?
I'll let others go first.
Oh, okay. I'll certainly add you though. Bob Howarth.
Thank you, and thank you for that incredible presentation. I'm very heartened by what I hear. Let me just briefly comment that I think it's great that you're proposing we can reach a 28% reduction in emissions from this sector by 2030. That's, of course, less than we have to do on average across all the sectors, but I think this is perhaps the hardest sector to tackle with our existing building stock, which is part of the reason I made the point this morning that transportation really has to do better. So I commend you on where you've come there, and you have fairly ambitious timeframes, which I think are great. You might get some pushback on those, but I think we need to stick to that level of ambition if we're going to even reach this 28% reduction by 2030. So I really do applaud you for that, and I applaud you for taking on explicitly the gas system transition, which, of course, has to be well thought out. I do have one question. You concentrated a lot on, well, both single-family homes and multifamily homes, but I didn't hear you specifically talk about renters. And at least in our part of upstate New York, a lot of the single family homes are in fact rented. And I'm wondering if you've thought explicitly about incentives for people who own the homes that are being rented specifically to address that stock. But and specifically, you talked about a rating system for homes before they're sold, perhaps a similar rating system for homes that are rented, which talks explicitly about where they sit in this energy space, might be helpful.
Thank you. That's a great question. We, unfortunately, if it wasn't explicit, apologies for that. We really intended the low and moderate income households to represent both renters and homeowners. And when we talk about disadvantaged communities, obviously the renters and the homeowners that live in those communities. So our panel was very thoughtful, especially about renters and impact on renters, as you heard me mention a little bit there around affordable housing and public housing. So the recommendations are really meant to be comprehensive and include renters as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Bob. Next up was Paul. Paul Shepson.
Thank you, Tori. So I want to channel Bob a little bit further, but first let me say how impressive the analysis is. It's really quite exciting. Except that, as Bob pointed out, if we follow the recommendations of the transportation panel and the buildings panel, we're not going to get to where we need to be in 2030. And so I've got two questions. I'm sorry, Doreen. Yeah, you'll have to get me demerits or something.
Questions are good. Statements I'm trying to avoid.
Yeah. Okay. No more statements. My first question is a process question, maybe for Doreen and Basil. Related to this, will the integration analysis take this into account, where we are relative to what we've heard today, and do more than integration analysis and work on, you know, what additional steps must be taken to hit hit the 40% target. My other question, which could be for Ruthanne or Janet or Marie, is to what extent would you say the shortfall is a matter of resources? Or is it, it more other issues, technical issues, timing related to reaching the end of lifespan for heating equipment, for example? So that's it. Two questions.
Great. Yeah, I'll take the first, Paul, just to clarify how the integration analysis is intended to follow. Notably, we are planning a number of different scenarios as being part of the integration analysis, which will help us really look at these trade-offs that you're articulating here. We're starting to see sort of this come forth in some of the panel recommendations, but further, it does help us just to evaluate the risks of achievement and the trade-offs associated with it, essentially through those scenarios. And I would say, just for the members, for your awareness, we certainly are going to be consulting with the council members on the development of those scenarios, as well as, starting with what we call a reference case, which is the base case to achieve the objectives, and then the relative scenarios to look at those trade-offs. Next question wasn't for me, I don't think.
Yeah, I think I can pick up on the other part of Paul's question about, what is constraining progress in the near term. And we did debate and consider this quite a bit. You will note that a lot of the emission reductions are being achieved by regulatory signals. And I would say the majority of the panel was not of the position that we could substantially accelerate those regulatory signals greater than what we've put forward to really drive progress by 2030. There were some panel members who thought there were a few areas we could push a little more, but by and large, our sense was, you need several years for a regulatory signal to take hold. So that was one of the constraining factors around 2030 and how hard we could push. And we did also consider a couple of other things regarding how hard to push in the near term. The need to build up the workforce is quite significant. We also were mindful of how quickly we can replace equipment in terms of electrification, looking at stock turnover. And then there's also this issue of phasing out of the global warming forcing refrigerants, which, that's a regional, national, sort of global commodity issue, which constrained us. I will say, to sort of reiterate Doreen's point, our panel did identify some things that could be explored in the integration analysis if we needed to move more aggressively. But I would say it was the sense of the panel that if we want to accelerate stock turnover, which is what it takes to really reduce emissions, we probably will need to consider greater public incentives. So that's the trade-off that I think will need to be assessed as part of the integration analysis, looking at a few different scenarios. But I would say I do think this is one of the hardest areas to make progress in. Retrofitting existing buildings, I would put forward across all of our climate challenges, is right up there. So we pushed as hard as we thought we could reasonably move the market.
Very helpful. Thank you very much.
When Janet Joseph says something's hard, you have to take note. Thank you, Paul. Gavin, you're next.
Thank you, everybody. Just trying to read my scribble here. A couple things that I'd like to state, and this is around the gas system mitigation issue. I've been following very closely the power gen panel, and we're going to hear from that later. And there's a real glaring void of what is going to help move the grid forward. What is the next level of decarbonization? And I'm just trying to understand, where there's gaps there in technology, how do you equate that into some of your recommendations you have here to transition away from a natural gas heating system? And I didn't know if you could answer that question, because the two things don't seem to be on the same page.
Yeah, so I'll try, Gavin, to speak to the topic of zero carbon, low carbon solutions for heating, right? I think that's, if it's not natural gas, what is it? So, right. So heat pumps are commercially available. They are in widespread use throughout the globe, even in colder regions like Montreal, like northern Europe. So the technology exists to provide customers with reliable heating sources in New York's climate. And the heat pump technology has improved substantially just over the past decade. I will also note that the equipment manufacturers are very much paying attention to the needs of the Northeast, and they are substantially increasing their own research and development investments. And we're seeing new products come into the market every month around heat pumps. So the issue is getting the right heat pump in the right building and ensuring that the workforce is trained to do these installations. So it's not so much of a technology gap. It's about getting the right product in the right building and driving cost reduction. And we believe we can drive that cost reduction through the scale and the certainty of these regulatory signals. And the consideration regarding the application of different heat pump technologies did factor into our timelines for replacement in existing buildings commencing in 2030 and 2035. For new construction, we can do this today, and that timeline is proposed to be much more accelerated.
Thank you for that. The next question is, I've been harping at state leadership on a lot of this stuff through Section 7 of the CLCPA. I think, Commissioner, it was you that raised the issue of a cleaner concrete that's less carbon, and the state needs to show leadership. Is the state doing anything to show leadership on this at this point, or is it still just being discussed?
Well, certainly I would say with respect to on the affordable housing front, we are working, very hard to, we have over time been including many green standards and transitioning our portfolio and work really closely with NYSERDA on a lot of that. NYSERDA also has a number of programs that have been around for quite some time to provide incentives for the building sector to do this. But I think some of the discussion at our panel was subsidized sector of the economy is not as large as the whole. And so we really need to be getting at more market incentives and signaling that this is where we're going to get at some of the stuff Janet was just talking about, right? Like driving down prices for heat pumps to make them more competitive and really getting that transition to happen in a market-based way.
Okay. I got a couple questions around buildings. This is more of a building code question. I was thinking about this. Would appliances that use cleaner burning renewable liquid fuels, will they be considered for inclusion in this process? I think that's more directed at Janet.
Yeah. So our panel had some debate on the role of cleaner burning fuels like biofuels or renewable natural gas. And I would say we did not reach consensus on the role of those fuels as a core recommendation. We did and do, however, note that there may be some hard to electrify buildings where we might need to consider those types of low carbon solutions. So I think that is something that's going to have to be worked out as part of the regulatory process. And
okay,
certainly deliberated by the council.
Another question around buildings and biodiesel and the fact that the law in New York State requires blended heating, particularly in downstate. Has there been any talk by the panel about using a higher blended rate to achieve any of these carbon savings across the state and not just downstate?
So, again, there were some members of the panel who viewed higher blended biodiesel as a possible solution for decarbonizing buildings, but that was not a topic where we reached consensus on. But we did have discussion. We did bring in the representatives from the biodiesel board to share sort of their analysis on the role that type of a fuel could play.
I'll stop here, but I just want to say that I just don't know how we could put all these recommendations forward without having any analysis on consumer costs. We don't talk about what the impacts are on costs and whether it's affordable. And I just want to be on the record as being disappointed about that missing piece of the puzzle here, which is, I think, is really important.
I'll add on that and then Janet pick up. We spent a lot of time in the panel talking about costs. I think the costs are complex, right? In terms of, we looked at sort of unit costs about what it would take to upgrade a home, what it would take to upgrade a building, obviously when a building was built, the time when they go to upgrade, whether there's cost compression over that period of time or technology advances. So we did spend quite a bit of time looking at that. Jen, I don't know if you would sort of add on to that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll build it out a little bit and then maybe ask Vanessa Ulmer to share the results of some of the analysis. So we did look at the costs by individual use case to try to decarbonize single family buildings, multifamily buildings, commercial buildings. We looked at incremental costs. We looked at issues around payback. And we looked at the strategies that could be used to drive lower costs over time. We see a range of costs. It could be on the order of incremental costs, on the order of a couple of $1,000s for a single family home to on the higher end of excess of $25,000 for a multifamily unit that is in a state of disrepair. So the cost varies, as the commissioner said, and it's a function of the state of the building. It's a function of the electric prices in the region, if we're talking about electrification. And that is the type of cost range. Now, for a customer that is switching from oil to electrification, there could be a payback to decarbonize on the order of several years, like 6 to 9 years. So the customer economics for those who heat with oil, for those who certainly have electric resistance, is actually quite positive. The bigger and tougher nut to crack is around natural gas. With the current price structure of natural gas, it's hard to make the case around economics for this transition, which is why this panel dug into the broader natural gas issue as well. So not to minimize this, but we have looked at it extensively and would be glad to share the analysis that we've done. I think we shared some of it after the February briefing. So I don't know, Vanessa has been our technical lead on some of the cost analysis, if there's anything else to add from a consumer perspective.
Vanessa, you're on mute.
Thank you. Yeah, I think you covered it really well, both Commissioner and Janet. Just to underscore kind of the high-low, again, for new construction, it's a very promising story. We're really already there or very close to being able to build all electric buildings that meet our current efficient codes, you know, at essentially no incremental cost once the builders kind of figure out how to do that and take an integrated design approach. It's the older building stock, and particularly buildings with high preventative maintenance needs or buildings that will need to upgrade their wiring or electrical panels, where it does become challenging and expensive. I mean, and also there's uncertainty. So we heard that a lot from, you know, multifamily building representatives, and it's true that there's uncertainty about what the costs are going to be once you start undertaking that type of construction project, and there aren't enough examples in the market that building owners can look to currently. So we do need, you know, public investment in order to help those leaders make those investments and then share those use cases, and then public investment, you know, on an ongoing basis for the lower income housing stock.
Thank you, Vanessa, and thanks for the questions, Gavin. I'm gonna move on to Don.
Thanks, Doreen. Thank you, everyone. And I will try to limit these to questions, and I'll try to limit the number because I have more questions than I think we have time for. So the first is around customer impacts. and the cost of the electrification mandate. And I think Gavin, you know, already touched on it, but I'm just going to hit it again. And I'm just curious, as you guys look at this, so many studies are coming out recently that use sort of a broad array of solutions. So, you know, you'll see a high electrification case versus a maybe more of a diversified approach or a lower electrification case, whatever the consultant might call it. And I'm curious why we went to what seems to be a very high electrification, or an Uber, I would call it, electrification case for buildings. And I wonder, because when I see these other studies, I'm happy to name them, I'm sure you guys have seen them as well. You know, they point out the benefits of having, for one, I know we've talked about it at meetings off camera, I guess, about hybrid solutions, hybrid heating solutions that I think the New York City study that recently came out includes, that talks about the benefits of less of a grid build out needed, lower winter peak requirements, and added resilience for energy delivery. So I was wondering about that and the extent to which those were considered. So that was question number one. Should I keep going, or do you want me to?
Well, I could pick up on that one. So we can try to do a quick response.
Yep.
So, you know, our panel was very focused on trying to prioritize and trying to really go after the big prizes, if you will, where we could achieve the majority of greenhouse gas reductions. And that's what we have presented here. You know, that said, I made one little statement in the presentation about we need to be mindful of the extenuating circumstances across the 6 million buildings that we have, and acknowledging that there might be some hard to electrify solutions. So even in our own modeling, we are not assuming that we get to 100% building electrification. So I want to underscore that. I think the assumption was that maybe we get to something on the order of 85%. Vanessa could jump in with the right number. So we do expect that there will be some buildings for which we cannot electrify. But by and large, we operated from the position of, you know, electrification being a primary strategy to drive emission reduction, an acknowledgement that there will be some hard to electrify buildings, there will be some extenuating circumstances, and we will need to work through the solutions for that part of our built environment.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. And I would like to, maybe this isn't the appropriate time, but forward these other studies that have recently been issued that talk about these things, maybe to expand the set of studies that were being considered, at least on the slides that you all forwarded, if that's okay.
Right.
So my second question really is around, we talked about it earlier, this sort of, I think Peter used the term harmonizing of the demand side of, you know, growth through electrification through a mandate like this versus the greening of the grid as the grid is decarbonizing. And how are we assured that, or how can we maybe better tie together the pace of this kind of electrification with the pace of the grid decarbonization? And I think, I know we'll get to it, but I think what's being suggested on the power gen panel is an iterative process, sort of checking progress, seeing how they're doing and reevaluating. And I wonder if it wouldn't be of benefit to everyone if we had a similar process on this side, on the demand side. I just wonder if that's something we might consider.
Don, I guess the only thing I'll add to that is we certainly fully expect that as part of the integration analysis, we will be mapping out the cleaning of the grid and then overlaying the timeline that was proposed for electrification from this panel as one of the starting points. So that will provide one level of insight. But, I think your basic point about iterations is consistent with what Doreen laid out of needing to look at different scenarios.
I guess the concern I have is just that, you know, these I think could be costly, and I'm sorry to interrupt. These could be costly. The gas scenarios, I think what was shown in February was between $20,000 and $50,000 per conversion, if I have that right, for gas, depending, you know, on the type of home. And so I just wonder if to have that kind of potentially costly impact as a mandate when we aren't certain that it would actually reduce emissions? That's really why I'm asking. That's the reason.
Yeah. And the only other point on the timing is realize the bulk of these mandates would kick in after 2030 when 70% of our grid will be renewable. So just we were mindful of that. And we do know that even if people were to switch from fossil today to electric, it reduces emissions today, even with the current grid. So that's a pretty compelling data point as well.
Yeah, I do think, though, it's fair to say that this is dynamic, Donna, definitely so. You know, where we sit today, I'm certain that we'll be looking at different cost curves, different grid characteristics, et cetera, into the future that will require us just to stay on top of these issues as we move forward.
Thank you. And I guess I'll ask one more if that's okay. And that is relative to kind of this question of resilience. You know, we've been talking about it throughout the day today. We've talked about it at prior meetings. How do these recommendations impact energy delivery, reliability, and resiliency for consumers as the grid is going to be, generated by renewables? In our region, we've talked about this, we have about 94% of the energy going into people's homes in the winter from the gas distribution system. And it's storm hardened and it's resilient. So I'm just curious how that's all factoring in. Thank you.
I think we'll hear a little bit more about grid modernization and resilience of the electric power system in the next presentation. So I won't go there, but from the standpoint of the deliberations of the Energy Efficiency and Housing Panel, we considered sort of three tiers of resiliency as we look to this future. The first is certainly the reliable, resilient power grid. Fundamentally, then kind of moving on down to the community level, we can minimize risk through certain types of warming and cooling and centers of refuge. This is something that I believe Sarah touched on this morning, and we'll also hear from the resiliency and adaptation group about that. And then at the building level, we are recommending several changes in the state code that would support more resilient buildings and efficient, flexible technologies to enhance grid reliability and resilience, including high performance walls, roof, windows that would improve passive survivability, solar PV, along with energy storage readiness and grid interactive appliances. But this is an area that warrants continued research, development, and analysis as our system evolves. It's a very important and significant area.
Yeah, and I do think, Donna, that Sarah Osgood will likely speak to the question of reliability in the next presentation, but totally agree that we certainly need reliability to be met, both with respect to distribution and the bulk system, as is always the case.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Donna. We'll move on to our last three. I believe I'll double check. Raya, next.
Hello, thank you. I just, congratulations to the you, to the panelists for putting together really comprehensive and thoughtful recommendations. What I see to be some really bold code recommendations that I really look forward to digging in on. I hope, we get a lot of those, into the plan, and impressive enabling recommendations, including, K-12, big comprehensive public education that's culturally sensitive, and very much want to thank you for diversity in the sector, including supports for NWBEs, B Corps, et cetera. And really a lot of comprehensiveness, so I really just have a couple questions. One, and you did allude to it, but what are your recommendations with regard to consumer protection? And second, what are your thoughts on how we can ensure that these industries, that the industries that make the parks, et cetera, also take hold in New York State?
Thanks for that. There was certainly a lot of
thoughts from our panel around making sure that this is really an inclusive process, and there's going to be a lot of change, whether that was on job training or on access to financing. And so we really, as I had said early on, sort of everyone really felt that was sort of a central tenet. Look, I think from the perspective of state spending and in some of the things we've talked about, right, there is a real focus on leading by that and making sure that we are making sure that there's access to MWBs and SDVBs and also access for venture capital and other expertise to make sure that it's sort of a rising tide lifts all boats effort. But it's gonna be a consistent and constant effort, right? This is a decades long endeavor. So I think part of the onus on this for state agencies and the state in general is making sure that there's reporting and there's transparency on all that so that we're all held accountable on it. And it isn't just a first push effort, but it's really a continued effort year over year and perhaps decade over decade. I don't know, Janet, if you would add to that or. And Ryan, did I miss the first part of your question?
Oh, just Rick, thank you so much for that. I couldn't agree more with the accountability. Thank you for saying that. And just recommendations about consumer protection, and any thoughts about how do we make sure that these industries related to energy efficiency, making the materials, making the parts, take hold in New York State?
I mean, I think on the first part, we had a lot of discussion about public awareness campaigns, and I think that's sort of key to making sure that people don't get taken advantage of. And there was a fair amount of discussion about, you know, predatory equity coming in to pay for things that are not, you know, necessary and taking advantage of often already disenfranchised communities. So I think we have to make sure that we do a big, bold education campaign and that it's targeted to the right people in the right languages and with the right cultural sensitivities so that everyone can be aware of all of that. And I think that's sort of our best foot forward on that part.
Yeah. And regarding building the clean energy industry in New York, which I think was your second part, you know, we have opportunities here to build up the supply chain for the clean energy products for buildings, in addition to building the local workforce. It's inherently local, but you're probably familiar with some of the things that New York is doing with respect to building the local offshore wind economy. We can do the same thing around certain building products, and we're having conversations with suppliers and manufacturers of major commercial, you know, heating and cooling systems. We're talking to these companies about expanding their local operations, their local service operations, in addition to the, you know, technician training. So we are trying to work at multiple levels to build up that supply chain for the clean energy industry looking at buildings. One of our initiatives around the Empire Building Challenge is very much trying to do that. We're trying to draw demand from large property owners and get the solution providers from across the globe to kind of pay attention to New York, and trying to see, working with ESD and others, if we can help entice them to set up operation here in New York. But there's, you know, a lot to do on that front, but I think we have a decent opportunity of really creating some more local clean energy, clean tech jobs.
Thank you so much. What a thoughtful, smart, comprehensive set of recommendations.
Yeah, thanks, Raya. And it's from these types of goals that these opportunities exist. Like, that's the precondition for all of this, is that New York needs to lead the way with respect to our ambition. And with that ambition comes these investments. Those two are linked. And we can be sort of selfish about drawing the industry here because of that. So that's really a really positive outcome. Next up is Dennis. Dennis?
Thank you, Doreen. I really like that last statement, Janet, that you made about building in New York. I do believe that's our biggest opportunity. We have a lot of people paying attention to our goals, but it needs to be more than gold. It needs to be creating these type of manufacturing job opportunities, control our own supply chain. And I would then also include in your statement to entice and incentivize those individuals to build in our Rust Belt communities as a function of our smart growth approach here. My question's on financial incentives. So we've got the benchmarking on building use, and I know that the utilities through the Public Service Commission are doing an assessment on distribution systems. I don't know what the extent of that is. The hope is that it's going to come up with projected costs, select hotspots, prioritize distribution feeders as we go forward. So the question is, from a financial incentive, have we looked at those type of business models that look at community-based non-wires alternatives, microgrids, system solutions like heat pumps / storage / AMI, if it's less expensive to go with a market option than a utility option, has that been considered, or just incentives and grants?
So that's kind of a broad question. I'm trying to figure out where to tackle that. We certainly are looking well beyond incentives and grants. I think the Public Service Commission has started the non-wires alternative a number of years ago. I suspect that will evolve as the commission grapples with the future of the gas industry. So I think there's a lot of PSC work that will happen. I will say at the work of the Energy Efficiency and Housing Panel was probably a bit more focused at the individual building level. But we do have other work going on in the state where we are looking at system and community solutions, multi-building solutions for things like geothermal. And we are working with utilities in a few of these studies as well.
Yeah, I just, a non-wires alternative, traditionally those are prioritized by the utility in a very reactive manner. What I'm referring to is more of a forward view, so that we have time to plan and do a lot more community-based planning. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, and actually, Dennis, I think that is what is envisioned as part of this managed natural gas transition planning work that needs to happen.
Yeah, that's right. I'd agree, and certainly something that Dennis, we should cover and include our colleagues at the Department of Public Service as well. Let's move on to Peter, and then Rose.
Yeah, thanks, Doreen. I appreciate it. Commissioner Visnopoulos, and Janet, Joseph, you did some amazing work. I just wanted to, you know, thank you for the work and the presentation. It was really just wonderful, and I'm really pretty bullish on what you've laid out for us here. So I have a couple of clarifying questions, but and what I really am happy about is, I think in several instances we've heard so far different ways to get at the pollution reduction initiatives, and you guys went straight to the heart of the matter and didn't create for us to contemplate what I would describe as Rube Goldberg machines. Now we'll pause here as the participants all now Google that term, especially the emerging leaders who are listening to us. Very complex solutions, but you guys came up with eloquent, straightforward things. Unless I've got that wrong, I didn't hear these types of mechanisms to get to 100% electrification as quick as possible. Things like renewable natural gas and hydrogen combustion in particular. I can't for the life of me understand how we're going to why we would use renewable electricity to do electrolysis to create hydrogen only to burn it, particularly when we're going to have all these electric vehicles with batteries in them. Here are my three questions for you. Commissioner, you had mentioned in your presentation, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I heard, I didn't hear anything as like the funding source for it, but under enabling number one for the cross-cutting analysis, you mentioned $1 billion to help low and moderate income energy conversions, and I was wondering if you guys had a pay for in that. I'm sorry I missed it if you did say it. The second two are for you, Janet, real quickly. You mentioned legislation dealing with energy codes and standards. Is that the executive's program bill, the governor's program bill, or is there another piece of legislation that's out there? Because you mentioned there was something in the legislative hopper. And then the last one for you, Janet, is you were asked about the costs And you all gave a nice detailed sort of rundown of the cost impacts of some of these proposals. I'm assuming you also assess the benefits of that. You know, this DEC has the value of reducing carbon at $125 per ton just for CO2, 2,000 some odd for methane. I'm assuming you also looked at the benefits of these approaches too as you were looking at costs. It's not always one-sided.
So I can take the first one on the how do we pay for it. And look, we wanted to, you know, the looking at the scale, right, makes us all blush a bit. It's a big scale and a big endeavor. So I think we wanted to be out front about the cost. In terms of where it gets paid for, I think there's two things. One, there is a lot of public dollars now that the state spends on this type of work. So making sure we're aligning that spend to these goals, I think, is key. Two, I think we're all at this moment have a lot of eyes on the federal government, and are there going to be incremental resources coming that can help accelerate and amplify the work that the state's already doing? And three, I don't think it's, you know, unreasonable as we think about these, and I think this is true across all the other panels, as we get to an integrated look at the cost, to be thinking about additional public resources that have to go towards this, and, you know, where those come from, I think, is a part of a larger discussion, right, between the executive and the legislature about priorities and funding. But I think I don't think the panel thought they had to exactly identify where it would come from, as much as really establish a little bit of a marker, you know, that the cost is there and it has some magnitude to it.
Great. We'll add the CCIA to your list then. It's a wonderful piece of legislation that could think of a lot of good, including huge benefits.
And I can pick up on questions number two and three. There is indeed an active bill that would make some fundamental changes in the new construction building code, as well as a separate bill that is focusing on appliance standards. Those were introduced as governor program bills. I will note that both of those proposals sort of move us forward, but they are not the entirety of the package that has been put forward in terms of codes and standards. The change in the new construction code is very important, that the change that's been proposed this year, because it moves the code from what is currently a cost-based code to something that is more aligned with our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. So that is absolutely a necessary step. The appliance standard bill that has been proposed is the first piece of work. It's around just getting to, you know, all efficient appliances for those things that are not federally preempted, and that is a package that we have analyzed and provides extensive benefits for consumers. What has not yet been proposed is the tougher nut to crack, and that's around moving toward, you know, the all electric components that are being deliberated here. But those two bills would move us forward. And on the benefits piece, just very briefly, certainly, you know, we are mindful of the benefits. I think it's the sense of the collective team that the integration analysis is where we will quantify the benefits along with the costs. And that was part of the trepidation with sort of just moving forward with half of the equation. Through that analysis, we will look robustly at benefits and quantification, and we will look robustly at costs.
I'm glad you made that last point. I think it gets lost in some of the discussion when people look at costs. So thanks again, Jen, for reminding us of the integration analysis on benefits costs.
Thanks, Peter. And to close us out, last but not least, Rose.
I just have a very quick question. And by the way, Janet, Ruth Ann, it's just an awesome report. Just went right to the meat of all the issues, and you know, it's so much can't answer all, but you really got to all of the big ticket items that we have to address and prioritize. I just wanted to ask you, in terms of tax incentives, as you talked about bringing in the private capital, and I know, you know, tax incentives are fairly important, historic preservation, affordable housing. Are they viable? As I guess they're really on the fringe, but can they be useful? How useful can they be, both at the state and federal level?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as we looked to identify costs, as I sort of said to, you know, Peter, I don't think the panel was super specific in sort of where those would come from, but certainly in your former capacity and my current, tax incentives are a huge driver of production across the state, as you said, sort of historic tax credits and low-income housing tax credits. So I don't see a reason why a tax credit of some sort wouldn't be in the mix for consideration as we look at how to provide public resources for this, whether it's at the federal or state level.
Gotcha. That's it. All my other questions were asked.
Great. Well, thank you, Rose, for finishing us off. Although I do notice, Raya, your hand is still up. Are you satisfied or?
Taking it down.
Okay. Just making sure. Well, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Janet, and to the entire team for some great work and for this overall presentation.
Thank you.
Next slide, please. We are now going to pivot to the Power Generation Advisory Panel, our final presentation. In this case, our presentation will be from Sarah Osgood, the Director of Policy Implementation at the New York State Department of Public Service. As she transitions to our executive director, maybe even after today, right? Right, Sarah? Just kidding. But welcome, Sarah. We're looking forward to it.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Next slide, please. I'll jump right in. The Power Generation Advisory Panel has 16 members, and their experience and expertise ranges across the energy spectrum, from environmental to environmental justice organizations to trade organizations and developers. We had a diverse group of panel members, and the interdisciplinary nature of the group, I really do feel, helped to strengthen all of the recommendations that we're putting forth. And I think something to keep in mind as we move through this topic today, we feel we've looked at all of the issues before us from all angles, and I really do think the diversity of our group really aided in that effort. And I truly can't express the amount of gratitude for the panel members who put in the effort, as well as the state staff team. This was a huge effort, and thank you all for that work. Next slide, please. We feel we had strong public engagement throughout the process that started last fall. In total, we've had 11 public meetings that were announced on the Climate Act website. They were webcast to allow broad participation, and the panel meeting presentation and notes were posted following the public meetings. We also established an email address for comments, a hotline for folks to leave voice messages at, and a total of 5 public input sessions, 1 a dedicated evening session, and the remaining 4 followed public panel meetings during which draft recommendations were presented and discussed. We also issued a key group survey to gather feedback. And finally, we engaged other panels and working groups in the development of our recommendations. I'll also note that in addition to those listed here, we met with the utility consultation group, who also participated in discussions with transportation and energy efficiency and housing on the electrification discussion. Next slide, please. The Power Generation Panel has been guided by the statutory requirements in the CLCPA, 70% renewable electricity by 2030 and 100% emissions-free electricity by 2040. Given that, most of the strategies included here are enabling strategies without specific emissions reductions amount estimated for their contribution, and the actual emissions scenarios will depend on the electricity demands from other sectors, and that will be determined as part of the integration analysis. I do just want to point out to the council members, the full deck that was provided to you a week ago, I think, had an error in it in terms of the legend here. Fuel combustion is the orange piece of the stacked bar charts, the top piece. I think that was mislabeled in a prior version, so just wanted to draw your attention to that. Next slide, please. This slide might be familiar to some. It's the same as was presented by Chair Rhodes to the CAC back in February, but I'm including it here again as it helps provide some context with respect to our panel's approach to electrification and provides the basis for many of our draft recommendations. First, I want to speak to the principles that are listed on the left side of the screen. When the panel first started to meet, it developed a set of principles for which to guide our work. Those principles include reliability, equity, affordability, zero emission, and timely. The panel's approach to electrification is consistent with how it's approaching the necessary transition of the power sector, and it aligns with these principles. By building an extremely low carbon electricity system, we're provided the opportunity to decarbonize not just the electricity sector, but those other sectors that are currently primarily reliant on fossil fuels. However, it also does raise some challenges for the electricity grid that we need to remain mindful of, given the significant electrification, the significant load that we believe electrification will add. So our approach to electrification must recognize the importance of minimizing system costs, of balancing behind the meter costs with grid side costs. We need to ensure we have a flexible system that can respond to situational changes in real time. We need improved planning of the electric system and across energy systems to accommodate decarbonization. And so with all of that said, we actually don't have any specific recommendations related to electrification, but the plan to address electrification is included within the suite of draft recommendations that that we're putting forth here. Next slide, please. The panel recommendations can be grouped into four categories. The first is deployment of resources. How do we deploy the clean resources that are currently available to us so that we can accelerate the pace and reduce the cost of transitioning the electric grid? What are the critical elements to keep in mind as we transition? What advances do we need for the future? And finally, transitioning away from fossil fuels to meet our CLCPA targets. And I will say, we are putting forward what I think is a very robust package of recommendations here, but I do want to acknowledge that the state has already taken a number of steps to implement the CLCPA, including expanding the Clean Energy Standard, or CES. And so with respect to that, we have a lot of our recommendations here might sound a little bit like kind of keep doing what we're doing, but we do have important tweaks around the edges and suggestions for improvement as we move forward. And so with that, I will jump into the recommendations. If we can go to the next slide, please. Deployment of clean resources includes the growth of large-scale renewable energy generation, clean energy siting and community acceptance, distributed generation and distributed energy resources, existing storage technologies, and demand-side solutions. So first and foremost, we need to accelerate deployment of large-scale renewables, including solar, land-based wind, and offshore wind, in alignment with the Clean Energy Standard. And for this, we can build on the success that NYSERDA has had with their existing Tier 1, Tier 4, and offshore wind programs. And so what we recommend is continued evaluation and adjustment of the policies and procurement targets necessary to achieve the CLCPA targets, continue to support and appropriately staff successful programs and pursue regulatory changes. These are things like build ready, appropriate staffing for the new Office of Renewable Energy Siting and other permitting and procurement agencies, identifying key transmission and distribution upgrades, improvements, new line construction that is needed to deliver renewable energy from where it's built to where it's needed, and establishing a non-binding goal for the Office of Renewable Energy Siting with respect to the number of megawatts of renewable energy that should be permitted each year based on what's needed to achieve the 70 by 30 goal. Next slide, please. Complementing this continued procurement process, the power generation panel suggests a multi-pronged clean energy siting and community acceptance recommendation that supports the development and use of information and resources for local communities to make beneficial decisions. Included in this are development of a mapping tool to help municipal representatives and local communities make informed land use decisions and communicate local wants to developers, as well as a statewide public awareness campaign to inform New Yorkers about the climate crisis and the benefits to shifting to a clean energy economy. Next slide, please. Moving to smaller scale resources, we see clean distributed generation and distributed energy resources as means to generate electricity closer to end users, thereby increasing energy efficiency, reducing carbon pollution, improving grid resiliency, and potentially curtailing the need for costly transmission investments. There are several components related to this recommendation, but perhaps the most important is the need to increase hosting capacity to facilitate expansion of DG and DER. We see this occurring through proactive and timely investments in local transmission and distribution infrastructure, implementing improved mechanisms for sharing and allocation of the costs associated with these upgrades to reduce the burden on individual interconnecting projects, and accelerating adoption of innovative technologies and programs that increase hosting capacity. Additional components of this recommendation include the pace of interconnection and right-sizing human resources at the utilities to mitigate delays, as well as considering the use of rate design, compensation, and incentives to encourage high-benefit projects. Next slide, please. A portfolio of energy storage technologies will be needed as intermittent renewable penetration increases. Existing and newer, longer duration storage will be needed to maintain reliability as we approach 2040. As such, one of the key components we see to reaching our climate goals is increased deployment of existing energy storage technologies. And I'll speak to long duration storage a little bit later in the presentation. For this, we recommend updating the state's energy storage roadmap consistent with the considerably higher storage requirements that were identified in the power grid study, and establishing new targets and funding similar to the Clean Energy Standard for storage. We also feel that energy storage should be better integrated into energy delivery and transmission planning processes. The energy system modeling should be refined to consider and identify the need for storage resources with longer durations, and that there is continued work with the NYISO on market enhancements, including elimination of buyer-side mitigation for CLCCA resources, and that doing so could facilitate the resource transition and help to minimize costs to consumers. Next slide, please. Closing out the deployment of resources category, we have demand-side solutions. Responsive demand presents an opportunity to optimize for the lowest system cost and the most expeditious deployment of both clean supply and demand solutions. And this will become particularly important as our energy systems become more interdependent. The panel believes that responsive demand should be analyzed and appropriately modeled as part of future generation and energy supply and incorporated into system planning. It's also suggested that there may be data that, if it were made available, could facilitate markets for clean energy. And these pieces of data should be identified and made available as appropriate. The recommendation also embraces state and federal appliance standards, development of standards to enable opt-out demand flexibility programs rather than just opt-in, and to take another look at cost-benefit tests to more accurately assess the value of the investments that we're making. Next slide, please. The next group of recommendations could be characterized as elements that we believe are critical and that we must keep our eye on as we move forward with decarbonization. And in this category, we have reliability, access and affordability for all, and workforce development. Generation resources combined with transmission and distribution systems, control centers, and the wholesale markets provide a continuously operating, reliable system to service New York's electric needs. And all of these elements will need to transition and come together effectively to manage the transitioning grid, to provide a continuity of reliable power system, all while integrating the CLCPA. The recommendations to implement and achieve the CLCPA must support the high reliability standards that are in place in New York by implementing improvements and enhancements where needed, and sustaining the practices that provide high quality electric service. And if properly integrated, the additional clean distributed generation, storage, and large scale renewables, which the CLCPA will provide, will help to build a more flexible and resilient grid to address and mitigate the impacts of climate change. The panel recommends biennial checkpoints be conducted to assess the state of both power system reliability to ascertain if any program adjustments are needed to ensure continued safe and adequate electric service. power system studies and planning should also consider analyses to integrate climate change impacts as needed for reliability and resiliency, and of course to reflect the risks and reliability challenges as well. For market products, the market products, requirements, and technology standards needed to maintain reliability should also be updated through time so that all resources can participate in the market based on their attributes to provide the products and services needed for reliability. Moving on to access and affordability, we want to prioritize helping low-income customers and disadvantaged communities while also assuring that these communities will be able to afford and fully benefit from the state's transition to electrification. The state has a number of programs to do just that, such as the PSB's Energy Affordability Program that provides utility bill discounts for low-income customers, and the Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance's Home Energy Assistance Program, that's a mouthful, HEAP, that helps low-income individuals pay the cost of heating their homes. These programs should be monitored and modified where needed to ensure eligible households are identified and made aware of the opportunities, and that programs are aligned with efforts to encourage electrification, energy efficiency, and reduce use of fossil fuels. We can also create more coordination to help bring all the available resources together to help individuals. Next slide, please. For workforce development, we know that the transition to clean energy will create job opportunities, but we need to make it a priority to provide education and career opportunities for individuals with a focus on disadvantaged communities to enter the clean energy industry. We also need to ensure a just transition for people currently employed in fossil industries so their needs are met. Components for this recommendation include focusing on businesses and job opportunities not only around installation, but also manufacturing and the entire supply chain for the clean energy industry, something that I heard a few council members bring up earlier today. We also need to engage the clean energy industry to evaluate current and future workforce needs and help align training with needs and future jobs, including consideration of needs by geography. We need to scale up strategic partnerships in education and outreach efforts with an emphasis on disadvantaged communities, and we need to provide state agency coordination with various benefit programs. We'd like to create community to employment pipelines and career pathways that prioritize individuals in disadvantaged communities. And we believe that ensuring a clear ladder and pathway to secure jobs and careers with family sustaining wages and labor unions where possible can help. We also want to focus, we want to establish continuing education, certifications, and licensing in trades and professions for fossil fuel workers. Also important to hit on here is that there should be enhanced climate and clean energy decarbonization curricula in state-funded education at all levels. Next slide, please. The next group of recommendations is related to the solutions we need that are a bit more long-term in nature. When it comes to markets, we seek solutions that incentivize the desired resources, provide optimal, reliable grid management, and allow for technology and innovation to help achieve the CLCPA objectives while ensuring the benefits for and reducing impacts on disadvantaged communities. New York should work to remove unnecessary barriers to clean energy development, such as buyer-side mitigation rules, and to achieve markets rule reform to provide price signals for the grid attributes required to achieve the CLCPA and ensure that the rules that are in place to enable will enable clean energy solutions to provide those attributes. The panel didn't take a firm position on any particular mechanism, rather suggested an examination of several approaches, including changes to RGGI, carbon pricing, and clean dispatch credits to determine the most effective approach to incorporate environmental values in market pricing. The panel also recommended that the state increase its proactive advocacy at the NYISO and FERC to align markets and planning processes with CLCPA goals, and that earnings adjustment mechanisms be reviewed to evaluate how existing EAMs are working and identify whether any modifications related to decarbonization and social equity goals tied to the CLCPA are needed. For technology solutions, we looked at these in two buckets. The first is achievement of 70 by 30, and the second being achievement of 100% zero emission electricity by 2040. For 2030, we see the focus on aggressively deploying currently available solutions, including renewable energy and storage technologies, energy delivery, energy efficiency, as well as identifying technology gaps. For 2040, the focus is on identifying and developing needed solutions for dispatchable technologies. And here we want to identify, explore, evaluate, and develop dispatchable technologies and solutions as they emerge. We also believe that detailed holistic modeling within a zero emissions world should be used to identify the needed technologies, and NYSERDA should continue its innovation support activities. We've also included components here for advanced fuels and nuclear power. Though they are potential solutions that could be explored, the Power Gen panel does not suggest that these are the solutions or that they're the only technologies that should be investigated. But further analysis, technical development, and research is needed in order to determine the feasibility, climate impact, and health impacts of advanced fuels. For nuclear generation, the panel recognizes that the contribution of nuclear power to the 2040 resource mix is not yet determined, and that any additional policy actions that would be needed should be evaluated prior to the end of the zero emissions credit program in 2029. Next slide, please. Achieving the CLCPA's high renewable energy zero emission electricity system will require substantial amount of energy storage operating over various timescales, spanning from minutes to hours, days, weeks, and even longer. And that will be necessary to maintain grid flexibility, reliability, and resiliency. Programs and funding for research and demonstration projects for the development of large-scale and longer-duration storage should also be a focus for New York State. And that further research and development, as well as establishment of a center of excellence, could accelerate the deployment of long-duration storage. It could also help attract and engage relevant parties in collaborative efforts to address the challenges that are unique to long-duration storage, and help to establish New York as a leader in enabling the grid of the future and ensure that investments in clean energy technologies lead to job growth in New York State. For energy delivery and hosting capacity, we recommend expansion of electricity transmission and distribution systems to support delivery. This would include continuing with strategic long-term transmission and distribution investments and declaring public policy needs through the current NYISO PPTN process. We also suggest creation of a database to track penetration and identify where there may be room for renewable energy zones. Related to offshore wind, we suggest further planning should be conducted and system upgrades on Long Island and New York City pursued to facilitate interconnection of 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind. The state should also promote multi-port infrastructure investment to support and facilitate the growth of offshore wind industry in New York. More broadly, for planning processes moving forward, we need to incorporate and deploy advanced grid technology. Building on the power grid study, the state should continue R&D and rapid deployment of advanced grid technologies to alleviate transmission system bottlenecks, unbottle constrained resources, and optimize the utilization of existing transmission capacity and rights of way. We should also examine and, if needed, modify planning processes to encourage the incorporation of advanced technologies. And finally, for interconnection, we recommend exploring additional areas where the interconnection process can be improved. Next slide, please. The final category of groupings includes the recommendations we have to transition away from fossil fuels to meet the CLCPA targets. Natural gas significantly impacts both climate change and air quality in local communities. Because it's such an extensive network, the natural gas system, maintaining reliability and integrity of our current system while we quickly transition away from natural gas and decommission the system will be a challenge. As such, the power generation panel, and consistent with the energy efficiency and housing panel, recognize the need to phase out gas infrastructure and pipelines over time and decommission them with a managed, phased, and just transition to the maximum extent possible and as quickly as possible. The panel also suggests denying gas permits to avoid creating additional stranded assets to the extent that these actions can be taken consistent with reliability and safety. To address methane leakage, the panel recommends continuation of DEC's current efforts to promulgate regulations to decrease methane emissions from gas infrastructure, as well as expanding efforts to control, reduce, and eliminate methane emissions, for instance, through the use of leak detection and repair enhanced technology. We also suggest deployment of a program to accurately characterize gas infrastructure components for improved emissions estimates and inventory reporting, and development of an integrated plan, and to coordinate efforts with utilities, gas producers, infrastructure owners, and local municipalities to decommission infrastructure by implementing non-piped alternatives and detect and repair leaks in remaining gas infrastructure while maintaining affordable, safe, and reliable service. So that brings us to our final recommendation, retirement of fossil fuel generation facilities. Here, we as a panel believe there is a need to develop a plan and to implement regulations to phase out fossil generation as quickly as practicable, while also retaining reliability and prioritizing efforts to lower greenhouse gas emissions and co-pollutants in disadvantaged communities. Retiring fossil on the system will certainly be challenging, but we believe we're laying out a sound and reasonable approach to implementing the law before us and think that it could be modeled after the DEC peaker rule. There are three main components to the retirement of fossil generation facilities for which the panel reached consensus on, and those center on a planning process that I'll get to in a minute. But there's also a fourth component that I want to speak about first, which is a non-consensus recommendation with majority support of members who took a position. And that is a temporary moratorium on new or repowered fossil fuel generation facilities until the full consensus recommendation is adopted. The moratorium would be in place until the CAC finalizes its recommendations, emissions reductions regulations are promulgated by DEC, and the iterative planning process that I'm about to describe has commenced. During this time, new or repowered facilities would only be allowed to move forward with the licensing, permitting, and construction if a reliability need were confirmed by the New York Independent System Operator, NYISO. The alternative viewpoint that was expressed by some members instead recognized that the CLCPA requires state agencies to integrate consistency with the CLCPA into their decision-making, and that the iterative planning process of the consensus portion of this recommendation would provide the basis for determining how to phase down fossil resources reliably by 2040. And with that, it takes me back to the three components of the consensus recommendation. The first is a planning process to determine emissions reduction targets to reach zero emissions by 2040. The second is promulgation of emissions regulations by DEC in order to reach the 2040 goal. So similar to the peaker rule, any closures designated by the emissions regulations of fossil generation facilities would prompt a reliability needs analysis and identification of alternatives. And then third is an iterative planning process that builds on the first two components, where the progress, the reduction targets, the regulations, and the other mechanisms being utilized are evaluated and revised as necessary in order to ensure that we are on track to reach the 2040 goal. And there is a desire to have these three main components enacted as soon as possible by the relevant state agencies. And with that, I will move to my last slide. Overall, the recommendations put forth here to achieve 70 by 30 and zero emissions by 2040 will result in a decrease in greenhouse gas emissions and improved air quality, particularly in the communities where fossil generation is currently located. For disadvantaged communities in particular, our recommendations were developed with these communities in mind, and we think that taken as a whole, we are working to address some of the key power generation related issues surrounding these communities. First is air quality and health impact. We know that the closing of fossil fuel plants in disadvantaged communities will alleviate some of the undue burdens associated with local air emissions, with local emissions that impact air quality and affect human health. We also know that electrification will cause significant load growth between now and 2040. So we want to replace fossil generation, as well as avoid the need for new generation facilities with cleaner alternatives such as combinations of renewables, energy efficiency, demand response, load flexibility, storage, and transmission and distribution of benefits. Reducing methane emissions from natural gas infrastructure improves global air quality, especially in neighborhoods that have significant or older infrastructure. And also related to health and air quality, we need to consider the impact of any new technologies, and particularly as advanced fuels like renewable natural gas or hydrogen are advanced, we need to ensure that they do not exacerbate air quality, especially in already disadvantaged communities. Affordability is another real concern for disadvantaged communities, and a lot of times we think of this, we might think of the monthly utility bill. It starts there, but it certainly goes beyond that. Power outages also have a disproportionate impact on disadvantaged communities because they're less able to afford measures to mitigate the human safety and health risks or to recover from potential loss of property. And as fossil generation facilities close, the impact of the lost tax revenue must also be examined within these communities and a transition identified. But the takeaway here is that affordability really needs to be considered across the spectrum of activities, but this is in no way meant to indicate that that we shouldn't be taking action, and it cannot be an excuse to delay action here. And so that brings us to access and participation. Access is something that we often hear alongside affordability as a central concern for low-income and otherwise disadvantaged individuals. We need to remedy that by providing quality information and trusted resources to increase awareness of opportunities and projects available to individuals in those communities. For example, energy efficiency, distributed energy resources, and load flexibility are effective avenues for individuals and disadvantaged communities to own clean energy solutions that provide benefits at the household, utility, and community levels. And when paired with direct assistance programs, they can also be helpful for low-income individuals to control their energy costs. Workforce development in clean energy can provide the much-needed education, skills, and training to communities, as well as open career pathways for individuals. And so moving over to the just transition aspects, we feel that scaling up investments in dynamic load management and energy efficiency will create jobs in part of the clean energy sector that has the most growth potential, and that energy efficiency and load management implementation can also help businesses reduce their costs. New businesses and industries will grow in New York State centered around clean energy technologies and their supply chains. And we have the opportunity to become a clean energy technology development hub and attract clean energy R&D and additional investments for the state. There will be a growth in career paths for workers who want to enter these new fields and for incumbent energy workers who are looking to transition. And the transition away from fossil plants will impact the workers of those facilities and their host communities. So as the natural gas system transitions, job availability and roles within the sector may change, and it's important to have training and support through that transition. And I'll just wrap by saying that maintaining a reliable power system overall is necessary to support the businesses, industries, and workers in New York. Although care must also be taken to not allow the cost of energy for businesses to become uncompetitive and prove economically difficult for high energy using industries. And so really, I think it requires a lot of balance and a lot of integrated analysis. And that's what we feel that our panel has put forward. And with that, I am happy to stop talking, take a little sip of water, and see if there are any questions for me.
Thank you, Sarah. And again, thanks to the entire panel. Looking at the list, I think it's important to start with Chair Howard for his feedback and input.
Thank you. This is mostly to say thank you so much to Sarah for her hard work. And during the transition at the commission, we didn't drop the ball and we didn't miss a beat. And I know I certainly wouldn't be able to do it without you, and really do appreciate this. And I do appreciate everybody's work on the panel as well. Again, Sarah, since you're only moving down the road, this is all good, and you're an indispensable resource. And again, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, I saw Gavin. Next.
All right, Dorian, I wasn't ready for the audible, but I'll try. First of all, I followed this group very closely just because of the nature of my job. And I think Chairman Howard's comments are right on the mark. Sarah really did a nice job in the middle of a transition. And I have a few questions, but I have some observations. One, I give credit to the working group, which worked very hard at trying to come up with some really good recommendations. And I think overall, they did a great job. I have some issues with some of them, as we all do with all these different working groups. But the fact that such a diverse group really recognized the importance of reliability is huge, and that being your number one principle. The iterative planning process, I think, is critical. I think it's rarely important that the state of New York seriously consider a robust energy planning system, which I think we've gotten away from over the last few years, that deals with NYSERDA, DEC, PSC, the ISO. I think most of us are very familiar with the agencies and the good work they do. So I think that would be very important to have a robust public participation as we try to achieve these goals. So I'd ask the state to take that back as a consideration. And you know, hats off to Jared Snyder and Commissioner Sagos. One of the things that really worked well was the PECA regulation and how the PECA regulation was rolled out, how the DEC met with the ISO, and there were really important studies and consideration about the reliability impact. So I think a model following the PECA regulation would be really important. In your presentation, the fact you mentioned carbon pricing and keep it on the table as a mechanism is something that my organization feels very strongly about, and I'm pleased to see that today. We need dispatchable generation, and along those lines, we talked about, and you had a slide in there, I missed it, but you had a slide earlier that talked about future technologies and what those technologies are. I think it's incumbent upon the state of New York to focus on what those dispatchable technologies are, so we get back to the number one principle on reliability. And I think that the more serious, a more serious effort by the state to look at those technologies is hugely important. Along the lines of questions, and I have more, but I want to let others talk. Did you guys consider carbon sequestration at all in the deliberations of the working group?
So carbon sequestration did come up. I honestly, we didn't spend a lot of time on it. I think it while it definitely is not necessarily a fuel, I think it kind of falls into the category of the advanced fuels piece, where the panel felt there's a big emphasis on the panel of let's focus on getting the clean energy deployed, and kind of the what do we need to lead with, and then we can figure out how much of a gap we have over time, kind of in that, you know, that last the last couple megawatts, the last percentage, how do we make that transition. And so we really kind of put it, because of that, I think the focus is more on saying, look, there might be opportunities for that in the future, and we need to look at R&D. But I think at the same time, there wasn't enough confidence in that technology right now to say that's something that we need to put increased focus on, as opposed to renewable fuels or something like that.
I see. Something that I just think is the wrong label is saying that we're going to have a non-consensus recommendation on gas moratorium. I just think it's bad for economic development. It's bad for private investment in New York to even have it out there. I understand what the committee discussed or the panel discussed, but just optically, it sends a message that New York is closed for business. And I just think that's the wrong message that should be out there. But along those lines, if a gas moratorium was implemented, did the panel talk about what do we do with those stranded investments and how do you handle that as a state?
So I think, yes, there was talk about having the managed phase transition planning that was similar to what the Energy Efficiency and Housing Panel put forth in terms of how do we transition the natural gas system. I think there was thinking that when you combine, when you also are take, you'd be rolling out kind of those plans at the same time as you have this temporary moratorium. So then when the Climate Action Council puts out its final scoping plan and the regulations are then adopted, that you could hit the ground running with potential solutions there.
Okay. That's it for right now, Sarah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gavin. Next up was Dennis.
Thank you, Doreen. Sarah, very nice job, as all the groups have come. You've definitely compiled some great subject matter experts in your group, and I appreciate that. But, as a Climate Action Council, we're starting to try and look at now all of these recommendations, and what I'm trying to get my arms around is priority. And I know some of these priorities are simply set by dates. But some of these are just costs that I'm trying to get my arms around. And if I look at the goal of 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind, and I look at what the cost of that is, and the only model I think I have is deep water wind was $10 million a megawatt. So if we get the scale over time, is that $5 million a megawatt? And then you multiply that by your goal of 9,000, it comes up like on a pure cost basis at $45 billion to achieve up to 15% of greenhouse gases. So how do we prioritize that against what the two presentations were today, which was the buildings and transportation, and that's 66% of greenhouse gases. So that's kind of like one question is your thoughts on prioritizing. The second question is just a clarification. You used the frame responsive demand when you were talking about battery storage or storage technologies in general, most of which I think is focused on the grid level side, which is more on the supply side of the electric system. And are you anticipating more of a move towards the demand side or the point of use side so that we're bringing more resiliency and demand and load profile control at the load center? So just wanted to get a clarification on what you're referring to as responsive demand. And are we moving towards more on-site storage?
So I'm going to take these a little bit out of order. On your demand side question, I think here we really are looking at the opportunity for increasing demand side solutions. And so that it goes beyond. So it is exactly what you were saying about trying to addressed if we've, rather than having the peakers come up, if we've got load pockets, is there, are there other opportunities where we can reduce load to have those fossil facilities run less? We've talked about, as a panel, and apologies, it's like it's hard to cram the 8 months of work that we've had into a 30-minute presentation, but we did talk a lot about how, you know, we kind of need to attack this from all angles, and I think that kind of goes to some of what you were saying from the prioritization perspective. I mean, honestly, I think the council and that will include me working with you guys, I think that's up for us to try to figure out how to prioritize all of this. There's been an incredible amount of work that I think has been done by the panel up until now. There's a lot of good recommendations in here, and now it's about kind of seeing how they can all fit together and stack up to give us the whole economy that we need. But honestly, I think that the biggest challenge is balancing all of this. I don't think that we can do this transition in in a series type way. It's not like we have to get everybody to have panels, solar panels on the roof, and then we're going to say, okay, and now go get your electric car, and we'll plug you into that. Like it's and that's really, I think, the challenge ahead for us. What we're envisioning here is a massive change to our economy, our energy systems, the way we, life as we know it. Sorry to be a little dramatic there, but I think these are massive changes that we're talking about. They cannot happen overnight. I think there's a lot of work that's going to go into figuring out how these pieces weave together and work for all New Yorkers, including, those that don't have the resources to, just go out and make these changes on their own if they wanted to.
Yes,
so it's
Sarah,
kind of a
some of that is where I was going, is that, the way we do planning or the way we've done it is we've focused on the supply side. We've built out renewable energy, solar farms, and now we're looking at offshore wind, et cetera. And then what we discover is there's an intermittency issue. And so we then do grid level storage. And then we discover that these entities are not located next to load centers. Then we do a transmission system upgrade. My point about getting ahead of that on the distribution side is we actually can start forecasting what the impact will be. We certainly have to develop what the cost to achieve will be. But let's not come up with demand side solutions, adding heat pumps, adding different types of systems, and not thinking about storing batteries, storing energy at that point. Because if we don't, then we're going to put out solutions and then have to go in for a distribution system upgrade. That's what I'm, and it's not you, believe me, it's with all of these recommendations, I just wanted to understand what goes through my mind. So I just want to tell you, I appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. Just on the offshore wind point that you had made as an example, it's a great example of, well, first of all, the 9 gigawatts is part of the Climate Act. It's included 9 gigawatts by 2035, so it is ours to implement at this point. But it is also the case that through that scale, we see, just like we were talking about with the prior panel, we see the cost reductions coming our way that come from that magnitude and the associated investments. I would say that it is complicated, and certainly when we think about costs, we need to think about it from the perspective of consumer costs, what consumers are ultimately paying for their energy supply, not as much with respect to the investment. And the metric that we use and that this panel discussed is the fact that we already spend $50 billion a year on energy in New York State. So now what is before us is, how do we redirect that spending to advance clean energy, which is the basic premise of the Climate Act and the transition that we seek. So either way, that's certainly the planning that is underway, and we certainly can agree with you on the need for that.
that process point that you had made. Moving on to Bob, who is next?
Thank you, Doreen, and thank you, Sarah. Great presentation. All the panels have done a wonderful job today. I have four questions. Let me go through them quickly, and I'll start with storage, picking up on what Dennis was just saying. In addition to electrical storage, are we thinking at all about thermal storage and various timescales? You know, heat pumps, it seems to me if you have thermal storage within your home to buffer out several hours of heating so you don't have to run the electricity on demand, that would work really well as a grid interaction. And thermal storage is a lot cheaper than electrical storage. So that's sort of a short-term storage. On a seasonal basis, I know there are multi-family homes in Saskatchewan and Alberta that now heat by storing winter sun for the summer sun until the next winter. And those, they say, are cost-effective. So I'm wondering if we're thinking about those sort of options. We tend to be focused just on the grid aspect. And I think beyond electricity, we should be thinking broadly about energy and all aspects of energy storage. So that'd be my first question. Second is, I'm delighted to see New York moving aggressively on offshore wind. Are we thinking at all about offshore wind in Lake Ontario and Lake Erie, which also have strong wind fields? And as you know, we have a lot of resistance locally to some wind farms in part of upstate New York. My guess is that we'd do better in those lake areas. So is that part of the planning? Third, I'm delighted, as someone who's worried about methane for a long time, to see the DEC taking on reducing our emissions, and glad you mentioned that. I just want to point out, though, that most of the gas we use in the state's coming from Pennsylvania. Most of the methane emissions are in Pennsylvania, and under the CLCPA, we're supposed to account for that. It seems to me the only real option then is to reduce that use of gas, but I'm wondering if the state is thinking at all about trying to interact with Pennsylvania or other states to reduce emissions there. I assume not, but I'd like to know. And finally, thank you for bringing up the moratorium issue. We talked a little bit at the last meeting of the council about the cryptocurrencies issues that are happening in my start of the lake. You know, there's a abandoned coal plant reconverted to gas that's now proposed use by Greenwich and Seneca Lake just for Bitcoin mining. And, you know, if that proceeds, there are a lot of other such plants, certainly in the Finger Lakes, but across the state. And so I do think that those should be included in a moratorium until we get our act together in the council and the state and figure out how that interacts with the CLCPA goals. But my question is, are you explicitly including those non-grid players in your moratorium suggestion? Thank you.
I'm just writing down this last one so I don't forget it here. Okay. So on storage, I think we do tend to probably talk and think a little bit more about electric storage when we're talking about energy storage, but surely we do mean to have it be inclusive of thermal storage here as well. In terms of offshore wind and opportunities in the Great Lakes, we do also, we do see opportunities here as well. I will mention we got a handful of public comments that were on specific projects in the Great Lakes, and those public comments were generally against building out renewables there, but the panel did ultimately recommend that a study be conducted to look at the opportunity for to look at the opportunity for storage as well as clean generation opportunities related to the Great Lakes. And so I think that is something, we're not saying it's definitely something that needs to be implemented in terms of the actual deployment of the technologies, but we're saying it's worth taking a look at and determining the feasibility of. There's also, I believe, a feasibility study that NYSERDA is conducting related to the Great Lakes. But I don't know, Doreen, if you might want to, I don't know much more than just that. So if you want more information on that, I'd ask if someone from NYSERDA could potentially jump in on that. But I believe that's underway. In terms of reducing methane and interacting with others, we do see a strong opportunity to interact with others within New York State, particularly on like the local community side in addressing methane leakage. While I think our priority is probably on getting our own, you know, house shored up, I do see as, you know, as we move forward that we need to address the methane emissions that are occurring in our state that are also not under our jurisdiction. So like the interstate pipelines that go through New York, but don't have, but New York doesn't inject or use any of the gas. I think we need to look at opportunities to collaborate with those owners and authorities having jurisdiction to see what opportunities we have there. I don't think we can just ignore it, but it's probably not necessarily the first thing that we would want to tackle, given we have more control over other areas. And then finally, are we explicitly addressing the non-grid players? This is in relation to, I assume, the behind-the-meter generation, like Bitcoin operation. We've seen a lot of that in the news lately. I would say that while we didn't take on a recommendation to address that explicitly, we do have it included within the, it would be included in the planning process that we outlined in our last recommendation for phasing out fossil generation facilities. And so we do believe that we need to capture those, but unfortunately, the way the law is set up nowadays, I think it puts, it makes it challenging to not approve some of these facilities transitioning to behind the meter. And I think that's, it's, I've heard it as a concern from our chair, John Howard, about needing to tighten this up. And I think it's an area we need to have particular focus on going forward too.
Thank you for that. I agree it should be an important focus. The green plant on Seneca Lake is taking off. There are many others like that, and it could get out of control quickly and make it very difficult to hit our 2040 goals if we don't 2030 goals if we don't stay on top of it. Just going back to the methane, I think we should do whatever we can within our border, but I would imagine that well over 90% of the methane emissions associated with our fuel use in the state, which we take possession of under the CLCPA accounting, they don't occur in the state. They're in other jurisdictions. So I think we just need to recognize that and be cognizant of that in our planning. Thank you.
And, you know, if I could just respond to that, I think that also kind of goes to the importance of federal action here and about New York partnering with the federal government. This is going to be a big challenge, this transition. I don't think you know, those of us that are working in it, I think we believe that we can do it, but we know it's going to be a lot of work. And in areas where New York could be economically disadvantaged compared to other states by taking action, you know, and becoming a first mover, I think that's really, those are good areas for the federal government to step in and help so that we're not, that states aren't kind of reluctant to take action because they don't want it to hurt them economically. It's like, we all need to be doing this together. We all need to be moving towards this new economy. And while we love to be a first mover in New York, I think we also, we love that because we want to help show the way of everyone else to do it. And we really, this is an all hands on deck. Everybody needs to be doing this stuff.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Bob. And if you do, Bob, I'll send you a quick note with a link to the feasibility study we have underway for the offshore wind, the Great Lakes study. It was a commission order from October of last year that required us to commence that, and it's now underway.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Next up was Raya.
Hello, thank you, and thank you, Sarah, for a great presentation. I just wanted to say I certainly strongly support the non-consensus recommendation. I think that it sends a signal that we're serious about ending fossil fuels pursuant to the CLCPA. So I wanted to say that I also support the non-consensus recommendations. I do have two questions. One, a lot of the recommendations, while it's great, iterative planning processes, this is definitely the way forward. But I'm curious in terms of concreteness. So my first question is, do you have specific recommendations for rule or regulatory changes that we need to take right now to forward our clean energy goals? One thing could be increasing our storage limits, putting those northwards. My other question is about affordability. You mentioned HEAP and wanting to focus on HEAP more. I think that it's well understood that HEAP is really just a drop in the bucket. Like HEAP, the assistance program does not go anywhere near addressing the affordability needs that we have, especially now when so many folks are facing utility shutoffs. So what is are there recommendations for a more comprehensive solution to affordability there?
Okay, so I'll address your second one first. So I would agree, HEAP is something of a drop in the bucket, especially when we look at the need across the state and not just kind of those that are taking advantage of it. We do have the Energy Affordability Program that is funded. It was created by the PSC, and it's looking to have the energy burden of low-income New Yorkers no more than 6%. And that is a direct payment assistance program that is that goes towards helping reduce utility bills. Now, again, a few hundred million dollars a year. It is quite significant, but again, it's I think a lot of people could argue it's not enough. We do need to do a whole lot more here. I think when we look at it's kind of like we're trying to put all these pieces together and say, like, if we are going to be taking funding from HEAP, can we at least make sure that we're not using those assistance dollars to prolong the use of higher emitting units, whether it's in your own home and you have an old furnace. We want to make sure that we're trying to make changes and adjust the programs over time. And so it's not necessarily the only answer, but I think that it's a piece of that. I think the real message is we're trying to we need to do a better job about weaving the different programs that are available together so that we're looking at it from, let's go in and do efficiency, let's put on renewables, and then we can talk about reducing, doing payment assistance to actually cut the cost as well. And that doesn't necessarily have to be in that order, but we kind of need to be doing these things all together. When it comes to the energy affordability proceeding at the PSC, we do have a few recommendation components surrounding that, saying that we need to get better at identifying where or who those eligible individuals are and making sure that they're aware and taking advantage of the programs. And so it's not necessarily the only solution, but it's, again, kind of a piece of the puzzle that we need to help. We need to help bring these folks along. And again, I think we're looking at, as we move towards electrification, again, this is something that other states are going to be struggling with too. And I think there's a role for the federal government there. With regard to the storage targets, we do have, and this is kind of maybe a little bit goes to kind of what I was saying about some tweaks around the edges with the CLCPA. So the Clean Energy Standard has already been expanded to meet the procurement targets that are required in the CLCPA. So for the 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind, for instance, we already have that that program in place to ensure that we get there. But when it comes to energy storage, we did see a discrepancy between what our current energy storage targets are now and what we see as likely to be needed in this decarbonized world. And the power grid study did identify, I want to say it was on the order of 15 gigawatts or more of storage. When we're right now, we're looking at, you know, a goal of 6,000. And so really, I think, we do have recommendations to kind of, better integrate or tie together some of these analyses so that, you know, when we do an analysis here and we do one there, we can kind of tie them back and make sure they're all working towards that same, goal. So we do have particular recommendations around expanding the storage target to what we do believe that it will ultimately need to be in order to reach our 2040 goals. But I guess apologies for not being able to get to all the details in this, but happy to continue the conversation as well.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Raya. Donna was next on my list.
Thanks, Doreen. And thank you, Sarah. Congratulations again on your new role.
Thank you.
My real question is around the recommendation around decommissioning natural gas infrastructure. Can you talk more about that and what the basis is for that? And I'm just, what I'm wondering is, again, back to our prior discussion, so many studies are showing the benefits of leveraging that system. You leverage it in ways to move, low carbon fuels and as a storage asset, and as a resilience in play for consumers. So I'd like to hear more about that, and also how that might impact cost impacts for consumers. Back to the prior discussion around cost. It's a very reliable, resilient system. It's a, $16 billion asset or thereabouts.
So, and I think that's why you might have seen a lot of the planning, the study work that we're putting forward as a panel. Decommissioning, so the reason why the panel went there is there's a belief that if, as we move towards our renewable electricity goals, there will be less reliant on fossil gas for the, or fossil fuels generally for generation. And so, seeing that, we currently could be in a situation where we have assets that we're paying for beyond the time frame of the CLCPA, we just want to make sure that we're not exacerbating that issue and that when we're looking at systems that need to be repaired or upgraded, that we're also considering what alternatives are there. And so I don't think it's necessarily an answer of one size fits all for everyone. I think this is, I think that's why we're trying to say that it needs to be a managed, it needs to be a phased transition. Because we do have a reliable system now and resilient as well, but I think we also see folks, at least I seem to notice it, and maybe it's just since being at DPS, but folks are increasingly unhappy with any sort of reduction or period of time without electricity. And so even just a couple hours here and there can be tricky for folks. It's hard to plan around. So I do agree that maintaining a reliable, resilient system is necessary, but I don't think that that's that we just end the conversation there and say, so we can't change anything. And I feel like that's what we all just need to kind of come together, throw everything on the table and say, yep, what is it that we're trying to achieve? And let's try to figure this out together, because I know I don't have all the answers, and it doesn't seem like there are too many people that do have the answer that works for everyone. And so I think this is, it's all about balance. It's about communication. It's about involving folks. it's no doubt going to be difficult, but I think that it is kind of this is all an iterative process, and we're figuring this out as we go.
Yeah, thank you. As to the iterative process, is there any discussion around including sort of a cost evaluation along with the reliability grid readiness evaluation? It might be important to consider. In fact, I think it is important to consider.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think it's kind of tricky because I think a lot of people hear cost and they say, well, cost is not a reason to not take action. And we probably are all seen the little cartoon of, you know, dinosaurs saying, oh, but it's going to cost so much to stop the asteroid. So that is true, but I think we also don't have a choice. It's in the law. I think that we need to be looking at the options we have before us and looking at ways we can optimize them. I feel like it's very easy to pick one thing and say, you know, one aspect, whether it's cost or kind of the future, you know, of the planet for our children or something to say. It means that it's very clearly this is the answer. I feel like everybody has a different value system. Everybody looks at these issues a little bit differently. And it's important to kind of keep that in mind as we're looking at all of this, because what works for one individual, one family, one region even, might not work for another. And so that's why it's something of a, you know, kind of all hands on deck. We've got all of these strategies and now we've got to figure out how do we make them work. For everyone, because I don't think the answer is we don't care about cost and we just invest as much as we can everywhere we can. I think there's planning that needs to be involved. But I also think that the challenge of this is going to cost a lot or it's going to be really difficult to do or convince customers to take these actions, that also is not a reason to not make the change. And so I think we really need to figure out the right balance for what works for, you know, all New Yorkers, the folks that live here, the businesses, the folks, you know, that might be looking at bringing businesses here. So I guess my whole, you know, drumbeat all along has been, this is a big balancing game that we've got to figure out. And I guarantee that nobody's going to say, you know, we got the answer right. You know, everybody can say, oh, almost, but you should have done this or that. And I, you know, it's just something we're going to have to manage as we work through this together.
Thanks, Donna. And thanks, Sarah. I too will sound like a broken record, but I will remind you that we do have the integration analysis will include a total resource cost assessment. And it'll look at it across each sector, along with benefits. So just reminding everyone that that's yet to come. We have a comment from President Quiñones. Gil, next up.
That's correct. It's a comment, not a question. I just want to amplify what Sarah has been talking about, the complexity of this transition. As a generator, a transmission owner operator in a load serving entity to customers and to municipal utilities, you know, we have a front seat and firsthand experience on this at the Power Authority. We have an agreement with what's called the Peak Coalition, which is a coalition of environmental justice groups here in New York City, to explore how to do this transitioning our natural gas power plants to lower zero carbon resources and technologies by 2035, which is 5 years before the requirement of the law. And there are really two issues. We need to do that on an orderly fashion, while maintaining the reliability and resiliency requirements of the system. For example, New York City, because it's a load pocket, meaning there aren't enough transmission lines that go into New York City. There is currently a requirement that 80% of the forecasted customer demand must be met by generation in city to maintain the reliability and resiliency requirements of the city. So, and in certain neighborhoods or distribution networks, power plants are needed for voltage support and frequency regulation. Some of NYPA's power plants are also going to be relied upon for what's called black start. If the system goes down, similar to 2003, we have a system-wide blackout. Certain plants are going to be asked to run first to help restore the system. So this is a very important goal. We need to accelerate the decarbonization of the power sector to meet our climate change goals. And at the same time, we need to maintain our reliability and resiliency. We've seen it firsthand in California this past summer, where they almost lost their grid. We also saw it in Texas in February with the polar vortex there. So we should take that all into account, and I know we will. But I just want to highlight the complexity of this. It has to be all of the above. I'm glad to see today that we're really going for a deep energy efficiency. That's very, very important, especially as we electrify the economy. Demand response, grid modernization. We need to invest in our transmission and distribution system, both hardware and software, as we evolve the grid into a smart integrated energy network. And we need to invest in clean energy, distributed resources, both community-based and behind the meter. We also will need breakthroughs in new technology, especially in the areas of long-duration storage. When I say long duration, it's really multi-day duration storage and low or zero carbon fuels. We can't eliminate any potential solution at this time because this is so hard to do. There are studies in the state of Washington, California, that you can get to 70-80% renewable. That's possible with today's technologies, but going from that point to a lot higher than that is very difficult technically. And it becomes very expensive for what you're getting for the money that you're putting in. So we're hoping that NYPA can, because we're doing this with not only with the environmental justice groups here in New York City, but it will be an open source initiative so that all of us and other power plant owners can see and learn from what we're doing. But I just wanted to share and amplify what Sarah's been presenting to us, Sarah and team. And I do want to commend this working group for this tremendous work. I think this is a great start in our journey to decarbonize the power system. Thank you. Back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thanks for the on-the-ground work that I know you're advancing and learning from on behalf of all of us. Looks like we're closing out the panel discussion with Peter Iwanowitz. Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Doreen, and thanks for the reminder. If you weren't going to be the broken record, I was going to talk about benefits and costs and the integration analysis. My favorite topic, and I'm glad we're doing that. Sarah, great presentation. Thanks for all the hard work to you and the panel. It's really just good stuff to see. A couple clarifying questions. But before I do that, I just want a statement. We've talked a lot about costs and, you know, I've been trying to bring in societal benefits. I just want to throw a couple of figures out there for folks. You know, when you look at the value of reducing greenhouse gases, the DEC has put out there, those numbers I threw around, we're talking like tens of billions of dollars in benefits that are going to accrue as we, you know, eliminate our greenhouse gas emissions. Those dollars aren't going to disappear. We will see them in lower medical bills. We will see them as communities spend less to clean up after extreme weather events. We'll see them in lower property taxes and insurance bills. So these monies aren't going to sort of disappear in terms of like New York State being open and closed for business. Let me just look acutely, digging out and looking at the state energy plan. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong here. But the way I read the state energy plan is we spend about $25 billion every year just to move goods and people back and forth in the transportation system. Maybe that dollar figure is higher as the pump price goes up, but think of $25 billion. I think the energy plan also says that we lose about 80 to 85% of that dollar value to out-of-state oil interests. So pause with me for a minute and just reflect on the fact that we would keep that economic value here in New York State as we move ahead and decarbonize just the transportation sector. Again, 85% of that dollar stays in New York to benefit our economy. It doesn't flow to out-of-state oil interests. Okay, enough of my soapbox. If those figures need to be corrected, somebody will correct them. So Sarah, renewable natural gas, hydrogen, I wasn't sure if you said this or not, so I was just going to clarify. Did the panel look at combustion of those to generate electricity? And did the panel, if they did, how would that square with the zero emissions standard that's in law? I think there's a lot of people out there that think that the zero emissions 2040 goal is carbon free, but it's emissions free. I'm glad your presentation put that out there. So that's my first question, is on those two fuels. Are we talking about combustion, if at all? And then your presentation didn't go too deep on this, but the packet that was sent out in advance did have market-based initiatives, and specifically the ISO carbon adder. Was a pricing mechanism, and it would, you know, was described in the materials as something that could help achieve the CPA emissions goals. But to me, it doesn't achieve other mandates in terms of the 40% benefits of carbon prices and revenue collected from clean energy for frontline communities. I'm not sure if that was talked about a lot, so I'd like to hear that, but I would just gear us towards a recommendation that we would seriously look at pricing strategies that would be economy-wide, not transportation has a couple over here, and we've got the ISO maybe at or over here. I would really hope we move towards an economy-wide pricing discussion and fairly soon. And the ISO carbon adder is always, you know, I've always viewed it as a very complex tool, a Rube Goldberg-like a device. And I'm just not sure whether the concept of just amending law so the DEC could actually put that $50 per ton CO2 price into the emissions requirements or into the Title V requirements. Therefore, the value of that price of CO2 then added to emission standards could be classified as a clean energy fund, and then 40% of that would go back to the benefit of disadvantaged communities. I think it would be a more straightforward and less complex way of putting a price on carbon pollution for the power sector on top of what is already covered by Reggie. So I just don't know if there was a discussion about an alternative to that at all.
Okay, so we did discuss a couple of different options when it comes to incorporating environmental values, and certainly, you know, the carbon pricing proposal is out there, and we did talk about it a little bit as a panel. I think overall we're looking at or at least kind of one of the aspects we're looking at is, does this make sense from the residents or the ratepayers of New York? If we do this, is it a benefit for them? And I think that's what, when we look at these things, we want to make sure that we are actually benefiting those that we're intending to, and that we're not having kind of unintended consequences. And so I think with the NYISO carbon adder, we didn't land that was necessarily the best solution. And so we said we need to do more analysis. And so I, you know, while it was, you know, 8 months worth of work, I mean, those have been cram-packed with working group meetings. And, you know, I think it probably says a lot. We have a lot of really smart people working on these issues, and it's still not a clear answer of what makes the most sense. And I think this is all complicated stuff that we've got to, you know, look at from all different aspects and make sure that we're kind of taking the right steps forward. when it comes to combustion of advanced fuels, this did come up. We had conversations explicitly about kind of green hydrogen separate from the category of advanced fuels, and the panel has said that they do want the zero emission or low emission resources to be considered kind of first, and then to kind of work your way towards, you know, the less clean alternatives if we need to go there. But when we put forward recommendations regarding green hydrogen, what we mean, this panel means, is hydrogen that has been created from renewable electricity and that is not combusted. So it would be used in something else like a fuel cell or something. So we did talk about that, saying that we don't want and it wasn't a unanimous, you know, kind of panel position, but the extent possible is to minimize the combustion of advanced fuels. And then if I can just touch on to the cost aspects that you kind of bring up. I mean, I think I agree with you in that it would be wonderful if we didn't have kind of our funds flowing out of state for energy. But it's also, I think that the tricky part of the conversation, or at least the part that I see from being, you know, on the state side, is how do you convince customers that those benefits are actually going to accrue, and that they should make these choices? Because I know for me personally, I had an energy audit done to my home, and I didn't take action for a number of months, you know, I think it was, you know, like 15 months, because I was just like, oh, I don't really know. I couldn't make a decision. And I think I'm one of the folks that are, you know, one of the New Yorkers that is in a much better position, probably economically, with, you know, with what I have, yet it's still difficult for me to make a choice that is aligned with kind of what I do with my career, that I know is the right thing. But it's still like, is it worth it for me as an individual to invest here? And so I think when we talk about costs, it's easy to get caught up in whether it's in incremental cost, or is it total cost, and is it the state cost or customers. But ultimately, I think this transition, we do need to get a handle on the cost. We need to figure out how we're going to cover them. The cost can't be a reason to not take action. But I think we also need to be realistic that for a lot of people, cost is going to be a deciding factor. And we need to figure out how to move forward and not leave those folks behind. And so I'm with you. We need to get there. It's like, how quickly can we get there, and how do we work to bring everybody along with us? Because I think we can also be accused of being a nanny state and just saying, you know, this must be done, this must be done, this must be done for your own good, yet not everybody feels that way. So again, it's kind of back to the finding the right balance. How do we communicate, you know, the importance of these things? How do we help folks realize those benefits? Or is there something we can do to kind of better align the costs and benefits so that it's not as much of an economic decision?
Well, Sarah and Peter, I'm enjoying this dialogue, but I'm looking at the clock, and I'm going to need to close the meeting. Is it possible that we could move on here, Peter? Are you satisfied?
I have a 10-second rebuttal to Sarah's point of how we convince people and look at the huge inefficiencies of internal combustion engines in cars, and be straight with people to say that for every dollar you're putting into your tank, you're literally burning 70 cents of it, because it's just waste. The internal combustion engine can't be more efficient than 30% in its best day. An electric vehicle, you're only losing 10% in inefficiency. So, you know, head on with the argument of how wasteful internal combustion engine is, and people will understand that there's a better way to go from point A to point B. That's just one sector of the economy.
Well, Well, thank you for that. And thank you, Sarah, for your work in the panel and also in the presentation today. It was a long day, and I am pleased to tell you it is a wrap, folks, on the advisory panels and their progress. So many thanks to all who contributed to reaching this milestone and to the members for your active engagement throughout. So in terms of what to expect next, I have heard loud and clear that you, like me, would appreciate receiving a document which summarizes the recommendations of the panel members, just for the purposes of taking stock of all of the pieces that we've reviewed collectively now over the two meetings that you've participated in. So we will endeavor to circulate that document. It will take us a few days to get organized around this, so I'd say it'll be within a week or so for your use and review that we'll get that around, and hope it's as useful to you as it is to me as we take next steps. I also had wanted to mention the fact that in the course of our work with the panels, as I had described earlier, and including the input from various stakeholders, there have been a number of cross-cutting topics that have come up. Earlier today, I had mentioned the topic of climate finance as an example during the Transportation Advisory Panel presentation. Essentially, we can see a need and a benefit for us on focusing as a council on some of these cross-cutting topics over the course of the coming months, not only for our purposes of learning, but also discussion. And of course, it's possible that we may be called on to consider some of these concepts even this year. So there are topics that I think we would agree that engaging experts in these areas will best inform our ongoing council deliberations. So I would be on the lookout. We would look to hold some engagements with experts over the next several months to help us inform our discussions for the draft plan, again, that we'll be developing as the year goes on. So I would also say, in addition to those summaries of recommendations, please also be on the lookout. Notably, during our next meeting and perhaps before, on a pathway to conduct some cross-cutting expert engagement over the coming months. And as we look to our next Climate Action Council meeting, which as of this moment is scheduled for June 8th, although we do need to confirm that date, we will, at that meeting, be addressing adaptation and resilience recommendations, along with feedback from the Climate Justice Working Group on all of these recommendations that we have discussed. I know that's a topic that has been brought up multiple times, and I look forward in June to focusing on those areas. So again, we're currently identifying June 8th for that meeting, and we will have more formal announcements around that meeting when the plans are confirmed. So with those three reminders on the advisory panel recommendations, the expert engagement, and the June 8th meeting, I'm sure with my co-chair, want to thank you all for your engagement and expertise. It's very impressive, and the progress itself is impressive as well. Basil, would you like to say anything as we close out?
No, other than to say, wow, that was a very full day, and we could have at least tripled the day with all that content, and probably a great deal of the lingering Q&A that you all have about all these amazing points, but such is the nature of the calendar we have. Thank you again to everybody for your hard work. Lots more ahead for the next several decades, so keep it up.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon.
See ya. Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.